Let's get serious.
All right.
Seriously, let's get serious.
Welcome to episode 12 of The Good, The Bad, and The Wretched. As always, I'm Josh from the Video Graveyard, and alongside me is Chris.
What's happening?
And tonight we are doing a little bit of a detour from film, but we're still sort of staying within topic. We've decided to do soundtracks tonight.
Yep.
So with soundtracks, what we wanted to focus on tonight was soundtrack albums. So that would be albums that contain a number of songs as opposed to an album of a score or a composition by one particular composer.
Yes.
So this is more like albums that contain a bunch of, you know, for the most part, rock and roll songs.
You know, those things that people used to buy a lot in the 80s.
Yeah, you know, those things like albums.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I'm really dating myself, or CDs.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Or cassettes. Yeah. How's that for dating?
So back when they used to, not instead of downloading a song here and there, when people actually used to download actual things. Now, a lot of the things with soundtracks is that they were, you know, sometimes they were just cash grab commercial things. But other times, you know, they really seemed to actually mean a lot. And the way that the songs were put together actually came out with some really great various artist compilations.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of really cool ones out there. There's a lot of shite out there, too. But we're only going to talk about the cool ones. So, yeah, as I said, we're not going to talk about scores. That may be a future episode, but not in this one. Another thing we might touch on is when there's a song that's used in a movie in a particularly cool way, we might bring up some of that stuff.
Yeah, we'll do that near close to the end, I think.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about all genres. We both of us found that there wasn't a lot of stuff, at least that immediately came to mind in horror.
Yeah, but, not really.
Yeah, but there's definitely a lot of cool stuff out there, and so hopefully we're gonna be able to go through quite a few of them and maybe turn you on to some stuff you haven't heard, or maybe make you reminisce about some things that you used to really dig or still do.
We're hoping you can flitter your way over to YouTube and listen to some of these tunes after we talk about them and maybe learn about a new band.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So before that, as we usually do, we're going to talk about what we've been up to lately. Kind of ironically, Chris and I both ended up in Portland on the same weekend.
Yeah. That's Oregon, by the way.
Yeah, Portland, Oregon. So yeah. I guess the highlight of that trip for me was going to Powell's Books.
Which was mine too,
yeah,
of course.
I'm sure that was.
Yep.
So for those of you who don't know, it's the world's largest bookstore. And it's, I didn't really know what to think, but... very cool. I mean, they combine used and new books, so you can get all kinds of stuff from, you know, brand new releases to, like, what did I got a really cool out-of-print Russ Meyer biography.
Yeah.
And a really cool Black Sabbath biography called Paranoid.
Yeah, and I picked up a book written by one of the Yablans, who was presenter of the original Halloween movie that I didn't even know existed.
Right, yeah, that was a cool find.
And it's all about the making of Halloween from the producer's perspective. And I guess I learned later after I had got home that it was a print on demand book.
Oh, cool.
Which is kind of like, if you want to buy it, then you order it and they print it for you. So I guess it didn't actually have a publisher. It's self-published.
Nice.
So we'll see how that pans out. I saw it and I was like, well, I love Halloween, but I've never heard of this book. So $7 into my basket you go.
Well, even if you get a few new tidbits about the movie, I mean, Halloween's such a famous movie, but it is kind of cool to get from a different perspective.
I knew I might like the book when on the back cover they even mentioned that when he screened it, one of the premiere screenings was in like somewhere like 42nd Street or some, you know, a place where people will talk back to the screen and someone yells, "Kill the bitch," about Jamie Lee Curtis.
Really?
So I'm like, well, yeah, this might be an entertaining book.
Wow, yeah, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, and another thing about Powell's is it's the size of a city block.
Yeah, I didn't even get through all the rooms.
Yeah, and it's over 2 million books, and almost anything you're looking for, you can pretty much find there.
It was crazy. I mean, I spent probably an hour in the horror section alone.
Yep.
Then I probably spent at least another hour or two in the biographies and, you know, music and film books. And, yeah, it was crazy. There was just so much stuff to look at.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I go out there for 3 days, and we usually spend at least a full day in there.
Right on. That's really cool.
Right.
Another thing I got to do there was I got to see a gig at the Crystal Ballroom, which is a sort of a famous historic venue down there, and I got to see Stardust and White Dwarfs. who are a pretty cool psychedelic band. If you haven't heard of them, if you're a fan of like bands like the Flaming Lips, especially their earlier stuff, well worth checking out. The singer of Star Death is actually the Flaming Lips singer Wayne Coyne's, I think it's his nephew or something.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, but they were really good, really good, and it was really cool to see them in a place like that.
Yeah, I've never heard of them, and you had mentioned you were going to see them, and you said psychedelic, and I was like, oh, well, there's going to be a Rika pot on the air in that place tonight.
Yeah, I think those guys were all pretty high, but the reason I knew about them is because they actually did a record with the Flaming Lips, and I think Peaches was on it as well, and they re-recorded Dark Side of the
Moon. Oh, is that album? Yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, they didn't play anything off that. They did do a Stone Roses cover, which was pretty cool. And, yeah, it was a great gig. So, but definitely worth checking out that band if you haven't heard of them.
Yeah, I remember you actually pointing that album out to me once with the Flaming Lips doing Dark Side of the Moon. And I believe we listened to a little bit of it in your car.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, this is weird. I think I like it.
So. Yeah. I think they actually, I haven't really researched this, but I do kind of know it in my head. I think that Star Death and Flaming Lips also did like the same thing with the first Stone Roses album. Huh. So if you haven't heard that album, the first Stone Roses album, everyone, it's well worth picking up as well if you still buy albums. Yeah, it was great. It was great to see that. And yeah, Portland's a really cool city. Kind of what I expected, but a lot cooler than I expected. I thought it would be a lot more pretentious than it was.
Well, I remember what we were talking about at dinner right before we started recording here, where I said, Josh, I'm going to ask him about Portland. He's going to say, oh, too many fucking hipsters.
Yeah, but the hipsters there actually work. They actually do stuff. They actually make businesses and things like that, as opposed to, oh, I'm not going to slam my own city. So,
well, let's just say, the city we live in has a reputation as no fun city, and it's well deserved.
Yeah. And down there, I mean, I didn't feel judged. I mean, I felt like people were actually wanting to turn you on to things instead of judging you all the
time.
That's
one of the, like, I always wear nerd shirts.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wearing a nerd shirt right now. I'm wearing my Zombie Jesus shirt.
Yeah.
And I'm down there walking around. This isn't this visit. This is a prior visit, wearing a Pitfall shirt, the Atari 2600 shirt. And at least three people say to me, hey, man, that shirt is sweet.
Right on.
And it's only in a place like that that people would actually notice you're wearing a friggin' Atari 2600 shirt.
Yeah, no doubt.
And mention to you how cool it is.
Well, and they have a bar that's actually an arcade with old video games,
it's
right?
Called Ground Control. And they usually play 80s music, and it's a bar, and it's got all the old school machines. We made the mistake of going on a Monday, which was Metal Monday.
Oh.
And usually I'm into metal, but this was all death metal, which isn't my bag.
Right.
So you're sitting there trying to play Miss Pac-Man, and someone's like, and you're fucking dying left, right, and center, because there's no way you can concentrate on eating those pellets when you've got a guy screaming in your ear about Satan wanting to come and kill your babies and eat your intestines and shit like that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I should write death metal.
You should. Anyway, I'm looking forward to the next trip down there.
Yeah.
So going on to things that I've been up to watching lately, I guess the first thing is I've been continuing my Friday the 13th marathon here, and I've watched actually three since the last episode, seeing as it's been a little bit.
And actually, the first one we watched together after we recorded last episode.
That's true. So that was Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter. Now, this is the one that when we were talking about our Savini Tom Savini episode, this one came up as well, because this is the one where they brought Savini back to do the effects, and this is where Jason supposedly was going to die, and that was going to be the end of the
franchise. This was the one where they said the only reason that he came back to do the effects was they told him, this is the last one, do what you want to him.
Yeah.
And he sent him out in a hell of a good way in this movie. And this was also, like I've mentioned in the past, directed by Joseph Zito.
Right.
Who did The Prowler prior to this.
And Missing in Action.
He made Missing in Action and Red Scorpion. And he's made some good flicks. And this one's actually my second favorite of the series.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the more enjoyable ones. I mean, it was really great. The cast on this one was definitely above some of the other ones.
Crispin Glover alone.
Yeah, Crispin Glover doing his funky dance.
His dead fuck dance.
Yeah.
He's like, where's the corkscrew? That's my favorite line that he says in this entire movie.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that I learned that when he was doing that dance on set, he was actually doing it to Back in Black.
Oh, really?
So I'm curious to like maybe throw Back in Black on while I'm watching him do that and see if it syncs up a little better.
Yeah, but you'd have to figure out what part of Back in Black he's actually dancing to.
Yeah.
It's an experiment you should try.
I might try it. You're right.
There you go.
This also had Corey Feldman as a child actor, yep. And I actually didn't remember that at all.
I think this was his first movie.
Might have been. I don't know. But it was a surprise to me to see him so young, because I don't know why, but I wasn't even expecting that.
And it was
like,
cool
shit.
Because he was a horror movie freak, too, and he made all his own monster masks, his character did, and everything. And that was kind of a neat angle. I mean, it's an angle I hadn't seen in a horror movie up to that point, where they acknowledge there's these people out there like us who really love monster movies and horror movies and
things like
that.
Well, that guy in Part 3 had that, too, that annoying guy.
It's just they didn't really acknowledge that as much in the 80s. It was more when Scream and all those kind of movies came along that they started like making that more jackass. Assery horror movie fans are kind of silly stuff, and I found they treated it a bit more respectful in the Friday movies.
Totally agreed. We also had Peter Barton, and I remembered him from the Powers of Matthew Starr. This was sort of this 80s sci-fi kind of teenager show where he wore this ridiculous looking suit,
I had not seen, but then you made me watch the opening
intro,
credits on YouTube, and as soon as I saw those amazing, I'm using my fingers to do the italics around the word amazing.
Air quotes. Yeah.
The amazing effects and the fact that Lou Gossett Jr. is in it.
Yeah.
I now would like to watch this show.
And do you remember who else was in it?
Lance Guest.
No, the girl.
Oh, it was Amy Steele, who was the final girl in Friday the 13th Part 2.
Yeah, so even more reason to watch it. So we got two Friday the 13th alumni in the show.
Wasn't Lance Guest in it, though, too?
I'm not sure.
I thought maybe he was, and then I thought it would be ironic if he did The Last Starfighter. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just misremembering something there.
Yeah.
I think I probably am.
And, Peter Barton, I mean, I definitely remembered him from that, but he sort of faded into obscurity after that. He was pretty good in this movie. And it also had Lawrence Monisson, who was the star of The Last American Virgin, which is a pretty great sex comedy. Well, I don't know. It's not really a comedy, but...
Well, it's Canon Films.
Yeah. But he played the annoying guy in this one that was smoking dope and watching stag films. And it also had these really hot twins, Carrie and Camilla Moore.
The funny thing about the twins is they're British, but in the movie, one of them speaks with an accent and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really bizarre.
Yeah.
And I think I like Friday 4, Final Chapter, the best too, because it had a cool kickoff following up from Part 3, because it had, you know, Jason being carted away to the hospital.
Right.
Because from the results of Part 3. And then I thought the deaths in this one were pretty brutal.
They were pretty good.
Like, I liked the deaths. I liked the shower death, especially.
Yeah.
And there was just like, you know,
the
how
girl on the raft.
Yeah. And you know how all these movies, they have the part where they always find the bodies and everything.
Yeah.
I found that the actual way they presented that was really cool, too, because there was I believe it was this one where Jason opens the door and there was a body pinned up to the frame and he pulls it down. Or is that Part 6?
Not sure.
I might be getting it confused.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But I found the kills to be really good in this one. And I thought that if it was to be the final one, it was a pretty good kickoff.
It was a good one. Yeah, for sure. Definitely one of the... I mean, I've been watching them in order, and I still feel the series is on a good footing.
After 4, though, comes the absolute worst.
Yeah, so we'll move on to Part 5, and that one, this is the first time where it's called Friday the 13th Part 5, New Beginning, and this is definitely the one where I felt like, oh shit, this is what people talk about when they say the series kind of lost its way, and it did. I mean, so the big thing in this one is Jason really is only appearing, well, I don't know, spoiler alert. If you don't want to hear a spoiler.
I think you're safe with this.
Jason's only appears in some dream sequences, and they tried to take the series in a different direction. So this was directed by Danny Steinman. He hasn't done a lot. He did Savage Streets, and he did The Unseen.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't done a lot. But it's pretty much set at a mental halfway house. So it was pretty bloody. There was some nudity that I wasn't expecting.
I enjoyed the redneck family.
Yeah.
Their death scenes were pretty good, I thought.
Yeah, the motorbike, yeah.
And there was a flare scene that was cool. Like, the deaths were okay.
It was more violent
than
normal.
But the movie itself was just lame.
It was pretty lame. I didn't like the guy who played, Tommy?
Guy who played Tommy sucked in this one.
Yeah, but it did have Dudley from Different Strokes as this kid actor.
Okay.
Shavar Ross, he played, he was like this black kid that was like...
Wasn't he the one in the tracksuit?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That was Dudley from Different Strokes.
Okay.
I didn't realize that till afterwards.
Yeah, I remember you tweeting something about how he can escape the bicycle man, but he can't escape Jason or something along those lines.
But this had a really this one had one of my favorite deaths I've seen in the series so far, and that was the actress was named Deborah Voorhees, weirdly enough.
Hmm.
Playing this girl named Tina, and then anyway, there was a sex scene in the woods, and then she got it with some hedge clippers in the eyes.
Okay.
I thought that was pretty good.
My favorite death is actually in Jason Goes to Hell, but we'll talk about
I know exactly what you're talking about. Another notable thing about Friday 5 is that there was two alumni from Return of the Living Dead in this one. So it's kind of cool to see them. So Miguel Nunez, who played Spider in Return of the Living Dead, played a character named Demon, who was Shavar Ross's older brother, and he freaking song. It's gonna be stuck in my head again. He does this "Ooh Baby" song where he's like sitting on a toilet singing to his girlfriend, and then he gets killed by Jason in the outhouse.
How does it go?
I don't know.
Wow, it's stuck in your head. Hopefully, but you can't remember it.
Ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh. Why am I singing this?
That's some great lyric writing.
Anyway, it is catchy though. and the other person from Return of the Living Dead is Mark Venturini, who played Suicide. He was like the lead punk in Return of the Living Dead. He plays the guy that he's like chopping wood at the beginning.
And that guy
kills this like really annoying dude. Yeah. He just like takes the axe and just whacks the guy. That's Mark Venturini from Return of the Living Dead, who unfortunately passed away from leukemia shortly after.
New Beginning is just... I'm actually hesitant to call it my least favorite of the series, because there are ones that I think I equally dislike.
Yeah.
But I think the reason I don't like 5 is because it's like a cop-out, right? They said they were done with it, and then they brought it back. And if you're going to bring it back, that's fine. But don't bring it back and take away the main drawing card of the
movie.
Aren't
they kind of talking about doing that again now?
Well,
like, I've heard that the new Friday... They are making a new Friday the 13th movie now. And there's been different theories. I've heard that it's found footage.
No, that's not happening
anymore.
And then
I heard that there was no Jason. So I don't know what's going on, but it is really stupid to like make
a Friday
the 13th
movie. I think
the latest
news I heard about it was that it was going to be a prequel.
Ugh.
So
we get the backstory.
Yeah, like, which is what Rob Zombie really did a good fucking job of with his Halloween. I'll tell you that much. Yeah, let's not get started on that topic again, shall we?
Okay, so next up, I watched Friday the 13th Part 6,
which
Jason
is
Lives.
My favorite.
Perfect. Well, yeah, you told me that before I watched it, and it's definitely up there. I mean, I don't know if I'd be able to rank favorites at this point. I mean, I still think I'm kind of leaning towards Part 3 a little bit. But
you have childhood trauma about Part 3, so that's probably why.
But this is definitely up there. It was definitely a return to form. I was like, okay, they had a hiccup in Part 5, but they're back to, it's back to being enjoyable again.
And they also, because they hired Tom McLaughlin, who did One Dark Night back in 1982, which is this cool kind of kids stuck in a mortuary with like reanimated wizard zombie demon kind of things, which is kind of a cool movie.
Yeah.
And he basically said to them, I want to do this kind of funny.
Yeah.
I want to have some comedy in this, because all the other ones are sort of not much intentional comedy in them.
Right.
And they actually said, sure. And you can see that, because there is a lot of comedic scenes in this. There's the scene with the paintball.
Right.
People where Jason throws a guy into a tree and he leaves an imprint of a smiley face in the bark of the tree and things like that. Like, and just the whole ironic jokes about the girl getting killed and her visa floating in the water, like, or American Express card, don't leave home without it. And that's actually Tom McLaughlin's wife.
Oh, is it?
That actress who gets killed.
Oh, wow.
And I just found that the deaths in this were cool. It has an added benefit of having a really good Tommy Jarvis this time with Thom Matthews, who's from Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
And he's really good in it, I thought.
He was great, yeah. And it's good to see him again. He's done a bunch, but he hasn't really had a lot of starring roles, and it was great to see him back.
And that opening scene with Horshack from Welcome Back, Kotter, getting his heart punched out the back of him, because they basically do a Frankenstein monster beginning by shocking Jason back to life with electricity, and that's fucking awesome. That's one of my favorite scenes in the entire series.
Yeah, it's very
and
cool.
I just love that movie. I just think it's a more entertaining, wink wink at the audience, you've stuck with us through six of these Friday the 13th movies, here's something for you to enjoy kind of thing. I think they were really atoning for New Beginning with this one.
Yeah, because I gotta admit, after New Beginning I was a little bit do I really want to watch another one of these? So because I watched them quite soon after each other, and I was quite happy I watched
The Friday I usually every year everyone says watch a Friday the 13th movie on Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
And Jason Lives is the one I've definitely watched the most.
Yeah, for sure. This one also had, so far, who I thought was the best Jason, C.J. Graham playing Jason in this. He hasn't done anything else other than he played the lead villain in Highway to Hell, which was with this Christy Swanson movie. But
that's actually a pretty fun movie.
Yeah, but I thought this guy was the best Jason so far. It was the only time he played Jason. He's actually a nightclub owner or something, and it sort of fell into his lap, and he hasn't really done anything else.
Yeah, I probably he is up to point part six. Probably him and Richard Brooker from part three.
Yeah,
are the best two Jasons.
Yeah, this guy was really good, really menacing. I just felt this is where I really felt like this guy's an unstoppable, because he was like a zombie, right? Mm-hmm. But he really felt like that unstoppable.
I mean, the guy's
machine.
Fucking walking around snapping cops in half and knifing guys in their RVs while Alice Cooper drones on in the background. Yeah. And I just thought it was funny too that there's a scene in it where you see him at the summer camp and a little girl sees him and he doesn't fucking kill him.
Yeah.
He just looks at her and walks away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's cool that they kind of gave him that, I'm an unstoppable killing machine, but I ain't killing me no kids.
Yeah, no, this guy was the best Jason, I thought. This also had Jennifer Cook in it. She was Elizabeth in the VTV series.
Oh, okay.
I always thought she was really cute, but she played the sort of lead girl who...
the sheriff's daughter.
Helps out Thom Matthews. Another interesting thing about this is there was no nudity, and this was the first Friday the 13th movie where there was no nudity, which is kind of synonymous with the series, but this one there was none.
Yeah, that have sex and die trope.
Yeah, but it worked. I mean, it wasn't like I missed it.
I didn't even notice. Now you mention it now and I'm just like, huh, I didn't even notice.
Yeah, it was kind of, it's a bit controversial, well, not controversial, but
controversial for pervs.
People do bring it up that this one has no nudity. So I got to admit, I was a little bit but I didn't even notice. And this is also notable for having the Alice Cooper song in it.
He's back, the man behind the mask.
Yeah. Now, this one and four, for sure. I'm not sure about five, but these are also kind of known for having a shitload of cutscenes that are floating around out there somewhere, and I'm not sure why Paramount hasn't put together a definitive version of these movies.
Well, you're going to see that when you watch 7, too.
Oh, is that another one that has
one's notorious for having lots of MPAA cuts.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are actually included on the DVD, so you'll be able to at least see them. They're shitty quality, but at least you'll be able to see some of the cuts they made.
Yeah, it would be nice if they put together an unrated version of these ones.
Paramount has never really treated the series, though, with any much respect, to be honest, even though they were big money makers for the studio back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people are pissed. It pisses me off, and it pisses a lot of people off, because you're not going to find any more loyal fans than you are horror fans, right? We're going to be the guys who will go out and buy the double, triple dips if you add some uncut footage to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're not going to see someone who's going to go buy 14 copies of The Notebook because you're adding back in two minutes of footage each time or a new documentary. You're not going to get people who are into, romantic comedies or dramas or anything like going out and buying action figures. Check it out. I just bought this fucking Lloyd from Dumb and Dumber action figure. You're not going to see that,
I wonder
right?
if there probably is one.
Well, there might be, but I'm just... horror fans are the most loyal, most spend movie fans out there.
Yeah.
And Paramount's being stupid by not cashing in on that.
Well, even the fact that Paramount is putting these out in multiple releases, like they put them out kind of bare bones, and they put out these special editions, and they put them out on Blu-ray. Then there was that box set, you know, or that was before the Blu-rays, actually. But I know diehard fans that have bought every one of them.
Well, I bought the DVD box set. I bought the Blu-ray box set. I bought the first three on Blu-ray before they put out that box set. So, I mean, I've bought them a lot, too. The only thing I have to warn people about with that Blu-ray box set is that Jason Goes to Hell is not the unrated version,
which
means you're missing some of the tastiest gore.
Now, is that Paramount still?
It's actually Warner Brothers because Paramount licensed the first eight to Warner because Warner owns New Line. And New Line did Jason X, Jason Goes to Hell, Freddy versus Jason, and all those. So it kind of, it was a cool, kind of like what Scream did with the Halloween movies. They worked out a deal so that they could actually finally release a box set because the rights were all over the place.
Right.
So, I mean, nothing new in that set, but to have them on Blu-ray, I still bought it.
Yeah.
I still paid my $85 or whatever it was I paid for it so I could have all the movies, including the remake, in one set.
Right on. What's the next one I have to look forward to then? What's part 7?
Part 7 is A New Blood.
No, that was part... Oh, yeah, A New Blood.
Which is basically Carrie versus Jason.
All right, well, that's... So next time you'll probably be hearing about that.
Well, if you want... I don't want to spoil them for you, but you're looking at some low times the next couple movies, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've heard that. So. But then it comes back in part 9 in Jason Goes to Hell.
A little bit, yeah.
Anyway, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
One other movie I did want to do a shout out to was a movie called Contracted. It's from last year. I think it's from 2013,
It's 2013.
Directed by Eric Englund, who's an up and coming horror director. And this is a movie, I don't want to give too much away on this one, but it's a really cool take on like sort of the zombies and that type of thing. Pretty much this girl gets, date raped by this guy who had had sex with some sort of infected corpse.
So he's a real classy gentleman.
Real class act. Played by Simon Barrett. The guy he's a screenwriter with Adam Wingard. He plays this creepy guy.
Oh, I didn't know he was in this.
Yeah, he's not in it for long, but he's in it enough to make an impression.
Look at this movie on Netflix and go, maybe I should watch
this. It's got a cool cover, yeah, and it's a quick movie, but it's really neat because this girl gets date raped and then starts changing. So it's like she's got an STD and shit starts happening to her. But it's kind of neat because you don't know what's going on. Like, you're just like the character. You just don't really understand what's happening, and it just keeps going on. And you don't know where it's going. You don't know what she has. You don't know what the deal is. And it's quite engaging. I really liked it. There's a lot of, like, if you go on the internet and read reviews and stuff, it is one of these ones that there's mixed opinions. If you can just sort of go with it and enjoy the ride, I thought it was great. I was glued to the screen the whole time. There's a lot of complaints that, you know, things aren't explained properly and blah, blah, blah. It's because it's not all spelled out for you because you're kind of in the same position as the lead character.
Sometimes you don't need things spelled out for you, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes that makes things work better.
It did in this one. It was very engaging. Najara Townsend, who plays the lead, totally awesome. Like, she's gorgeous and just nailed it and had to do a lot of kind of gross stuff and nailed it. Just totally engaging. I was with her the whole time. And her mom in the movie was played by Caroline Williams, who played
Stretch
in Texas Chainsaw 2. But, highly recommend this one. But like I said...
pretty quick 80-some minutes, right?
70-something minutes.
Oh, it's even
quick.
Better.
It's a quick watch. But, I was glued to the screen the whole time. Really liked it.
Cool.
So what do you got, Chris?
What do I got? I'm just going to quickly run through mine. I don't have stuff I want to talk in any real depth about. But I did watch a bunch of movies because it's been a while since we recorded. I did go and watch Dog Day Afternoon on the big screen.
Oh, nice.
Which is the Sidney Lumet.
Where'd you see that?
They were doing it as part of the classic film series.
Oh, cool.
And it's the Sidney Lumet 1975 crime drama with Al Pacino. It's set in the heat during a heat wave in New York City, so it's got that grimy New York City feel. But it's about him and one of his cohorts going into a bank and robbing it and ending up having to take the tellers and the bank manager hostage. And it just follows them, their day being in this bank, trying to figure out a way to get out while they're being offered things by the police. And it comes out during the movie that he is doing this bank robbery so that his lover, his gay lover, who is played by Chris Sarandon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
From Fright Night, is
it? Yeah,
from Fright Night. And to get him a sex change operation, which to me is really interesting in the sense that this is 1975. Topics like this are completely taboo back then.
Yeah.
Like, this is a revelation that comes in that movie where you're shocked a little bit because you're not expecting it to go that way.
Yeah.
You're just expecting to be your typical crime drama where he's robbing the bank to get the money for something frivolous or stupid.
Yeah.
And it turns out that he's doing it for love.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really cool kind of twist on the bank robbery genre in a way. And it's still got some pretty dramatic stuff, but there's some comedy in there a little bit. And the finale's pretty sad. And it's also got Lance Hendrickson in it.
Briefly.
So you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know he was in it. I had forgotten. I'd seen the movie a long time ago, and I'd forgotten he was in it. And then he comes along, and I'm like, holy fuck, Lance Hendrickson.
Yeah.
Like, this movie just jumped up a little bit.
Totally.
But it's a really cool movie if you're into those 70s gritty crime, drama, thriller kind of movies. You know, there's Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, which was also Al Pacino, and French Connection. All these kind of movies that were coming out in the mid-70s just captured that decade.
Well, it's like the best part of the time for filmmaking.
Yeah, just
captured that
decade and brought it home. And so if you're interested in that, if you've never seen Dog Day Afternoon, highly recommended you check that
one
out.
And that's Pacino like at his peak.
Yeah.
Like, this is when, you know, Pacino's just become such a caricature almost like nowadays, as has Dustin Hoffman. But these guys back in the day were like unstoppable and just so engaging. And this is also based on a true story, which is cool.
Yeah. I researched the true story afterwards, and it's a really, really tragic kind of sad thing that happened. And I found that it was interesting to me that at the beginning, when he was being very, you know, against the cops and everything and being like very, you know, resistant to them and yelling Attica all the time and everything, all the crowds that were there were supporting him and being like, yeah, tell those fucking pigs and everything, right? And then when it comes out that he's a homosexual, he becomes a target of ridicule. And I just find that sad.
Yeah.
And it's a commentary from 1975 that still holds up to this day.
Yeah.
And I find that's really sad and makes me really, really feel bad for the way humanity is very unaccepting of certain things, even in 2015.
Yeah.
And another thing I watched was, I watched a movie, a Canadian movie called Monster Brawl, which is directed by Jesse Thomas Cook, who co-directed a cannibal, low-budget cannibal movie a couple years prior to this I kind of liked called Scarce.
Okay.
And it's really all this is, it's like a WWE live show, only with monsters duking it out in a graveyard.
Really? Is it like Arena or something?
They're in a wrestling ring.
No, but you know that movie Arena?
Yeah, it's kind of like Arena, only a lot more lower scale, if you can believe it.
Wow.
I mean, Charlie Band's low scale to begin with, but this is low scale. This is like one set, a graveyard set, wrestling ring in the middle. They clothesline each other. They body slam each other. You know,
Oh my God.
It's like Mummy versus Witch Woman.
Really?
Dracula versus Frankenstein. They've got commentary from Dave Foley and Art Hindle. Dave Foley's from the comedy
Art
show.
Art Hindle was in this?
Yes, he was a commentary, and he's drunk through the whole movie. He just gets hammered all the time. Dave Foley's from News Radio and Kids in the Hall sketch comedy show, and it's got the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart.
Wow, really?
Spending time making cameo appearances and hanging out with these hot bikini babes through the whole. It was fun. Like, there was a little bit of backstory for each character, like about how this chick becomes a witch because she's burned at the stake and that. And it's a low budget movie, and I've seen reviews online saying how it sucks and everything. I'm like, you're watching a fucking movie about monsters wrestling each other. What the hell are you expecting from this? Shut off your brain for fucking 90 minutes and just enjoy yourself. I mean, it did go a little bit long because it would have worked better as maybe like a 45 minute short or something.
Right.
Or an hour. But for an hour and a half, it did run a little long. But I mean, I had fun with it. It's got some hot chicks in bikinis. You know, it's got It's got the Wolfman doing elbow drops off the turnbuckles and stuff.
Sold, dude. I was not going to check that out until you just talked about it.
It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. Another movie I watched was New Year's Evil.
Okay,
which
yeah.
is the 1980 canon flick.
That just came out on Blu-ray,
it's
right?
It's just come out on Blu-ray from Scream Factory, but I watched it on TCM. Mm-hmm. I've actually had it on my PVR since before New Year's, but I was a lazy asshole.
Was it Scream Factory that put this out?
Yeah, Scream Factory put this out on Blu-ray. Okay. It's directed by Emmett Alston, who did Nine Deaths of the Ninja. Take from that what you want, because that's a pretty miserable little ninja movie. And it's got, it co-stars Grant Kramer as, main character is Roz Kelly, who plays a punk rock DJ kind of character who's having a New Year's party, and she gets a phone call from a psychopath saying, I'm going to kill people over as the clock strikes midnight. And it follows her talking to the cops and trying to figure out when this killer's coming for her, and the killer as he comes, kills people and works his way towards her. It's structured kind of like a crime thriller, but it's a slasher movie.
Hmm.
And it's got Grant Kramer in it playing her son. And Grant Kramer's from Hard Bodies and Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Okay.
And he has this really weird scene where he pulls a stocking over his head and like acts like he's fucking getting his jollies from it and everything. It's really bizarre, and it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie particularly.
Weird.
And I didn't really like it that much. Honestly, it was kind of slow, and there was just something in it that was, Kip Nivian was in it as the psychopath, and he was kind of awesome because he was just over the top. And I don't know. It was like, I didn't like it, but I didn't hate it. So let's just
Did you buy it?
I didn't. I taped it off TCM.
Okay.
So I'm just going to,
so are you going to buy it?
I'm not buying it.
Okay.
It's not worth buying to me.
So it's worth a watch, maybe.
Yeah, it's worth a watch if you're a
slasher completist.
If you're into those 80s slasher movies, it's worth seeing.
Right.
And then the only other movie I wanted to mention was Return of the Living Dead 2.
Okay.
Which I just put the review up on site for. It was the January Pick Our Brain choice by the readers.
Right.
And it's like I said in my review, the first movie was a punk rock, sarcastic, do you want a party blowout. This one is like a polite cocktail party where you're basically just, you know you've been to a cocktail party before, you know they're not that exciting. It's nothing new. It makes a lot of references to the first movie. There's a lot of jokes about the first movie. It's got Tom Matthews and
James Caron.
James Caron, yeah. Back from the first one playing different characters but being very similar to the first movie.
Right.
It resurrects lines and scenes from the first movie. It's more of a comedy. It was aimed more at teenagers.
Right.
So they said that basically if it wasn't for one scene in the movie, they would have got away with a PG-13 rating on it.
Hmm.
The zombies are more cartoony. You know,
is the tar man in it again?
The tar man is in it again briefly.
Yeah.
And, it was kind of fun. It was entertaining. I didn't hate it. It has enough.
I don't remember it.
It has enough comedic moments for me to enjoy it. It has it moves pretty quickly. It's Ken Wiederhorn wrote and directed it. He made Shockwaves, which is a Nazi zombie movie in 1977. And he made Meatballs Part 2, which is acknowledged by a lot of people as the worst Meatballs movie. But I kind of like it.
Ken Wiederhorn's not an endorsement to me.
Yeah, but no, it was pretty fun. It was okay.
I don't remember it. I mean, the first one's obviously classic. And I remember really digging the third one, but I I don't remember hating it or liking it. I just was sort of there.
If you want to know more, you can just go read my review. I'm not going to talk about it much more. And then the only two other things I wanted to mention is we're going to tie into Powell's a little bit here, just because if I go to Powell's, you obviously know I'm a reader. And I just read two books in the past month that I really, really loved. So I thought I'd share them with you. I read Gunnar Hansen's Chainsaw Confidential.
Oh, it was good.
It was really good. It's basically his recollection of filming the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It also has other cast members and crew members' recollections, and it follows from him being cast right through to the movie's premiere and its after effects and right up to modern day, kind of. And it's kind of cool hearing from a guy like him because, honestly, us horror people know Gunnar Hansen, but he hasn't had much of a acting career, if we want to be honest about it. And it's just cool that they actually gave him the chance to write a book about making this movie.
Yeah, that's great.
And it was a fun book, and I found there's a lot of information out there about Texas Chainsaw already, and I found I did learn a few things here and there that I didn't know.
Right.
So I would recommend you definitely give that a read if you're into movie books, especially ones about horror.
Yeah.
And the other book I wanted to give a ringing endorsement to was a book called The Deep by Nick Cutter. Now, Nick Cutter, it's interesting, is that that's a pseudonym.
Yeah.
He's a Canadian author. His name is Craig Davidson. And he's written books like Cataract City and Sarah Court. And he also wrote a short story collection called Rust and Bone, which was made into a Academy Award nominated film in 2006 for Best Foreign Picture called Rust and Bone.
So are those horror books or?
No, these are more literate books. He writes his horror books under this Nick Cutter name. He wrote a book last year called The Troop.
Yeah, I'm reading that right now.
Which is about a tapeworm basically invading a Boy Scout troop and making them kill each other.
Yeah.
And it's a really fun book. But this Deep book blows The Troop away. I loved The Troop, but this one, there's just something about this one because it's set in a bottom of the ocean research facility. So it's got that Leviathan vibe going on, but it's also got the isolation and the feeling of the compression of the sea pushing in on you and wanting to constantly crush you into little tiny pieces. But it's got a virus that causes a lot of psychological guilt and makes people have fucking weird hallucinations and things like that. And it's just a great little book. And I knew I would like it because I've liked everything this guy has written. My girlfriend actually says this guy's my new man crush. So I guess if Kurt Russell is my movie man crush, this guy's my book man crush at the moment.
Wow.
And I'd highly recommend you read this book if you're into psychological fucked up kind of horror books, because it's got a lot of that stuff in it.
Cool.
And I did find out that he also wrote a lot of other horror books under the name Patrick Lestiqua.
Oh, weird.
On small press books back in the day. And I actually found one of them at Powell's when I was there called The Preserve. And it was a autographed limited 400 print run of that book, and I got one
for
really
cheap
at Powell. So definitely check that book out. Really cool. Really cool.
Awesome. Well, let's get to our topic now. So I guess I don't know the way to go on this one. I think what we should just do is just what we normally do and just sort of start throwing out some titles and see where that goes.
Well,
and then
yeah, the way I structured my notes for this one is I kind of separated it for myself.
Okay.
Where I did a couple of ones that were from movies where the songs were actually a part of the movie. And what I mean by that is the movie is not a musical, but it's got something to do with musical acts doing the songs that appear on the soundtrack.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
All right.
So, I mean, you know, like...
Well, why don't we talk about... Okay.
Let's talk about the obvious ones.
I think the first thing we should talk about, just because... So, I mean, I think a lot of the time, you know, there's been a lot of times throughout, you know, film history where music has played a part in movies. But I think for our generation, I think that it really became prominent. And I mean, I'm other than like, say, Martin Scorsese, you know, who has, you know, we do see the use of music in Scorsese films like Goodfellas and stuff. But I mean, I think for our generation, the real person who brought this up for us was Quentin Tarantino.
Of course.
And he's the first guy that sort of really... tied music into scenes in a really good way consistently throughout his films.
Yep.
And B, kind of made a bit of an art out of the soundtrack album.
Yeah, and he also introduced a lot of the younger generations to songs, obscure songs or really cool songs that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's because of Tarantino and a movie like Pulp Fiction that Dusty Springfield can come back and have a resurgence of Son of a Preacher Man, and it becomes like a
radio staple.
A radio staple.
Again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, personally, I'm not a huge fan. Like, I enjoy Tarantino soundtracks for what they are, but I do own a few of them, but they're just not ones that I go back to very often. However, I can appreciate the way that Tarantino incorporates music into his films.
Right.
So, like, Res Dogs, I mean, of course, Stuck in the Middle by Steeler's Wheel.
Yep.
We all associate that. And this is what I was talking about earlier when we're talking about incorporating music with a scene. When I hear that song now,
we think
I think of
Michael
Madsen.
Yeah.
Right? What else happened in, you know, Hooked on a Feeling, Little Green Bag? Yeah. I mean, you know, we think of Little Green Bag. I believe that's the scene where they're all walking.
Well, I mean, who would have thought that this obscure little song by George Baker Selection called Little Green Bag would come back in the 90s?
Yeah.
That people would now know it. And that's because of Tarantino.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be a forgotten song if it wasn't for Reservoir Dogs.
No, absolutely. And the thing he did with the soundtrack album was kind of cool, too, because he took Stephen Wright, who was in the film as well, announcing the songs, K-Billy, whatever, super hits of the 70s. That's all incorporated in the soundtrack album, so you get all those little clips. He incorporated the Madonna speech from the diner into the soundtrack album. So
dick, 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 dick.
Yeah. So it really did. It really was a way to kind of revisit the movie and enjoy all these cool songs.
Well, yeah, and it was the first time that you, I mean, I was always cognizant of songs in movies, but I think it was Tarantino who made me more aware of the perfect placement of a song.
Yeah.
Because when Reservoir Dogs came out, I would have been in high school, and I had been into movies for a long time, but this is, when you become a teenager, is when you start kind of breaking them down in your head, like what makes them click for you as a person and why they're effective. Because when you're a kid, you're just like, that was entertaining. I like that, you know?
Yeah.
When you get to be older, you start thinking on this analytical sense where you're like, well, why is this scene affecting me in this way? Like, why is this working? And I think it was Reservoir Dogs and Tarantino that made me more aware of the perfect placement of a song makes your scene a lot more effective,
totally elevate a scene,
and stronger than it would have been if you just had a score playing in the background.
Absolutely, yeah. So when we get to Pulp Fiction, I mean, to me, this soundtrack didn't really hit me that much.
I actually found Pulp Fiction to be like the one that had the most memorable songs, though.
Now this is also, I think, a taste thing, right? I mean, I know a lot of people really love Pulp Fiction. I kind of dug it. It's just, it's not my favorite. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't really connect with the film that much.
So you and I would fight over this probably.
Totally. But, yeah. Well, I think I'd fight with a lot of people over this. But I mean, I love Pulp Fiction, right? But it's just, I never have the urge to go watch it.
Because you really cannot tell me in the last 20 years that there's been any more influential film ever than Pulp Fiction.
Absolutely not.
Like, you cannot deny that.
Absolutely
It's because of that movie that we have movies like Boondock Saints and things like that.
Wow.
Like, we have, or yay. You know, but you know what I mean? It's like, he brought a new style of film.
Absolutely.
To the forefront, and it's because
of
Pulp
Fiction. Was
that
Pulp Fiction or Res Dogs?
No, it was Pulp Fiction. It's totally Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, that movie should have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
Should have.
Yeah.
There's no movie more influential than that movie in the last 20 years, bar none.
Fair enough.
But we're talking about the soundtrack.
We are talking about the soundtrack.
So, for me, the soundtrack is, you know, Misery Lou by Dick Dale.
Okay.
This is like, you know, like I said, Dusty Springfield, Son of a Preacher Man.
When was the Dick Dale song?
Well, for the exact, I listen to the soundtrack a lot, so I can't remember the placement of the song in the actual movie.
Right.
I believe it was opening credits.
Okay.
I mean, and then you've got You Never Can Tell by Chuck Berry, which is during the famous dance scene between John Travolta and Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
And that's like a really famous, like, that's bringing Chuck Berry back to the forefront. And the only other song is, you know, the Urge Overkill cover of Neil Diamond's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Yeah.
And that's a really great cover for me.
But yeah, it's a good cover.
I just feel like the Dusty Springfield one is the song that benefited the most from that movie, in the sense that here's this British singer who isn't really that well known in North America. Like, I know them because I grew up in a British household and my mother loves Dusty Springfield. Mm-hmm. And we used to listen to Dusty Springfield vinyl all the time. And to have that song come back in a way that it's being played in clubs in the 90s to these early 20-year-olds who don't really know her just blows my mind.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I think Pulp Fiction, out of the Tarantino stuff, is the most influential soundtrack and movie.
But again, like, I can't play, maybe it's because I'm not a huge Pulp Fiction fan, I can't place that song in the movie.
Well,
so to me, it's like, I don't know if he did such a good job on this
one. Well, I think it's more that he, for me, I'm more familiar with the way the soundtrack plays out.
Right, so he made a great soundtrack album, but I don't know how well he did in this movie with incorporating these songs into the movie.
Well,
I'm sure a lot of Tarantino fans will disagree with me, but just even in this discussion, there's two songs that I've mentioned that you haven't been able to place in the movie. So I just don't know how effective of a job he did. But then again, I'm not as familiar with the movie as a lot of people, because I thought it was all right. I enjoyed it for what it was, but Pulp Fiction, just not on the pedestal for me that a lot of people put it
on. But also, when I was compiling this, I went with more of the fact of me listening to these soundtracks.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Disconnected from the movies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is the thing we were talking about scenes.
Yeah.
And having songs that were influential, which I did look at that factor, but I looked at it in the sense of being disconnected from soundtracks, in the sense that these scenes I'm going to mention later that have songs that tie in with the movie really well are ones that I am not talking about when I talk about soundtracks.
Yeah, and it's a difficult topic because a lot of the time I do like soundtracks for being basically glorified compilation albums.
Yes.
But I also like them because they remind me of the film.
Right.
And the thing with the Pulp Fiction soundtrack is it just doesn't really remind me of the film.
Right. Fair enough.
Now, that being said, I find that the Jackie Brown soundtrack does remind me of the film. I mean, they make a big deal in Jackie Brown about the Delphonics. Didn't I blow your mind this time?
Yes.
There's a big scene with Robert Forster and Pam Grier talking about the song. And she's going through a record collection. Then he, I think, goes and buys the album. So that very, very incorporating the Delphonics into this movie, and I don't even know if I'd know who the Delphonics were if it wasn't for I think I'd know, but I went and bought a Delphonics album after this, just like Robert Forster did.
Well, for me, Jackie Brown is the movie that I'm probably the least familiar with for Tarantino, because it's the one I've seen the least,
and it's my favorite Tarantino
and
film.
I own all of his films now on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So I keep on telling my girlfriend I want to start from the beginning, and I want to watch all these movies over again, and I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah, it'd be cool to do that, especially after this discussion.
For what I wrote down for Jackie Brown is, and remember, when I wrote these lists, I kind of disconnected myself from the movie and looked at them as albums.
Right.
I wrote down Bobby Womack's Across 110th Street,
which I believe was the opening
which
credits.
Is a great song about how hard it was to live on, like, in New York City.
From a great
singer.
And it's from a great black exploitation movie called Across 110th Street that Bobby Womack did the entire soundtrack for. But again, a great... So Jackie Brown obviously was an homage to black exploitation movies.
Yeah, and Foxy Brown, Pam Grier.
Yeah, so awesome for him to...
And he also brought Pam Grier into the soundtrack, right? Because he did Long Time Woman.
Very briefly, yeah.
I mean, it's on the soundtrack.
It is.
I mean, so that's why I feel like if I was to watch Foxy Brown again now, I would really dig it a lot more than I remember. I would dig it a lot more than I remember, because it is that blaxploitation homage.
Totally.
And that's the one I'm least familiar with.
Yeah.
So I do want to revisit that. But as a soundtrack, I do find that to be a really cool soundtrack, because it's got that Motown blaxploitation feel to it. I really find myself gravitating towards that a lot because there is a lot of soul in that music, and it's a lot of, you know, it's just, I find it more interesting than rock music in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's more from the heart in a way, I guess.
Yeah, I've got a lot of that to talk about during this whole podcast. But, I mean, Jack Brown, my favorite Tarantino movie, my favorite Tarantino soundtrack.
Okay.
Hands down.
Fair enough.
Kill Bill, I mean, now this one I do, I only wrote down a couple of notes on Kill Bill. The Nancy Sinatra song, Bang Bang, Baby Shot Me Down.
Everyone remembers These Boots Are Made for Walking, but Bang Bang is a way better fucking song.
Yeah, and then also... really creative use of Zamfir's The Lonely Shepherd in the final battle between Lucy Liu and the bride. Yeah. So,
and how can you forget the fact that Tarantino managed to make the 5, 6, 7, 8s briefly popular by putting them in the movie
in the middle of the carnage
the carnage scene. And, you know, that song Woohoo by them just became kind of a minor hit. And it's just this bizarre surf rock all-female Japanese band that nobody fucking knew who they were.
Yeah.
And for him to be able to make them kind of over in North America is a feat.
Totally.
So, I mean, that's pretty sweet, too.
So, again, I did buy both soundtracks.
I just found there's too much RZA in those soundtracks.
There is.
Yeah. That's my issue with those.
Yeah. And then Death Proof. So, good use of a T-Rex song. And yep, also, again, they talk quite a bit about the song Hold Tight by Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch or whatever
the by the way, I forgot to say that we're probably going to mispronounce a few names here.
Yeah, like I just did. Yep. Anyway, the song is discussed in the movie, and then it's used in an integral scene in the movie, which it's a driving scene. And again, like, very cool use of the movie, use of the song. I might not have even known the song had I not watched the movie. And they talk about it. So it's kind of cool. It kind of brings us back to the, you know, the other one I was talking about. Or, I don't remember what it was.
But so anyway, you were talking about the Delphonics.
Yeah, Delphonics, right. So, but again, like, I love that. I love that they're, like, talking about a song and the song's playing. And I think that's really cool.
Well, and also with him, I find that he does do a lot of cribbing from other movies and uses it creatively in his own. Because in Death Proof, he used The Last Race by Jack Nietzsche,
right,
which is from the 1965 Burt I. Gordon movie Village of the Giants.
Right.
And it's used effectively. I think it's used during a driving scene as well.
Okay.
And it's just, it's weird that he's calling back all these old songs that we might not know, but he's also calling back to him being a film nerd by bringing all these songs from all these other movies that he really loves and using them to his advantage in his films as well.
Well, and even, and when you do break down the soundtrack, like you have, as like a separate entity, there's some good tunes on there, and it's great to be able to discover some new songs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he does a great job, you know, but I guess in my brain, I'm tying them more to the films.
Right.
It can be a difference of opinion.
Well, yeah, and the only other Tarantino one I'd like to bring up is Django Unchained.
Right.
And that's simply because if you're going to make a movie that's a homage to spaghetti westerns and you're going to call it Django Unchained, you better fucking well have the song exactly. Django in it. And that song by Rocky Roberts and Louis Bacalov, I believe I said that right, is used in the opening credits. Yep. When Jamie Foxx's Django character is being dragged along as a slave. And I thought, as soon as that scene came up in the film, I was like, I'm fucking sold on this movie right here. Yeah. Just because he went and he used the song Django.
Well, he better have have. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. But there is a song on there that I really, really love that's on the soundtrack. I honestly can't tell you, remember where it was in the movie, but it's a newer song. It's by Anthony Hamilton and Elena Boynton called Freedom.
Okay.
And it's a very soulful song, kind of tied into slavery in a way, I guess, which the whole movie was in a way.
Yeah.
And it's just a very R&B Motown sounding song by these newer artists. And when I hear that song, when it comes up on my iPod on shuffle, I kind of get shivers.
Nice.
And that doesn't happen that often for me.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
It's a good soundtrack. It's another one where he peppers in a lot of cool dialogue from the movie. And any soundtrack that can manage to use I Got a Name by Jim Croce to its advantage,
nice,
I'm cool with.
Yeah. And again, like, I wasn't a huge fan of that movie, nor was I a huge fan of Inglourious Basterds.
Which is funny, because I think Django Unchained is his second best movie after Pulp Fiction.
Maybe you need to watch Jackie Brown again.
Maybe. Maybe.
Maybe you need to watch
Well, you want me to fucking bow to you if I watch Jackie Brown again and love it?
Not a lot of people love Jackie Brown, but I certainly do. Okay, so just riding on the Tarantino thing, I'd also like to bring up Paul Thomas Anderson, because I think Paul Thomas Anderson actually, at least on a couple of his movies. Now, I think Paul Thomas Anderson used to be my favorite director. Between Boogie Nights and Magnolia, I love both films.
Well, who doesn't fucking love Boogie Nights?
Right. But I didn't love The Master.
Neither did I.
Whatsoever.
That was an actor movie with kind of a weak plot.
Yeah. And then Inherent Vice, I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I can't judge
it. It's pretty fucking bizarre. Yeah. So it might be a return.
Well, it might be a return to The Master, too.
Yeah.
At any rate, the Boogie Nights soundtrack I found to be awesome. And I think Paul Thomas Anderson is actually a little better than Tarantino at incorporating music into his movies. I mean, there's the classic scene in Boogie Nights where Dirk Diggler is trying to do this, like, basically this drug shakedown thing at this house where Alfred Molina is. And he's there with, what, John C. Reilly and Thomas Jane, and they're, like, sitting on this couch. And you've got you've got Sister Christian playing, and then you've got Jesse's girl playing. You've got this Asian kid throwing firecrackers and fucking intensity building and building and building and building. And that's all I can think of when I hear either of those songs now. All I can think of on either of those songs is that scene.
Yeah.
And that to me is mastery of putting music into a movie. And P.T. Anderson, I think, does it better. He also incorporated Brand New Key by Melanie. That was when Dirk Diggler first does Roller Girl. Again, perfect use of the
Well, that definitely is.
Absolutely. You've got ELO in there. You've got the Commodores doing Machine Gun. You've got Marvin Gaye. You got the Emotions doing Best of My Love. It's a great fucking soundtrack.
You got fucking Dirk Diggler himself doing the Touch.
Oh, yeah, the Touch. Yeah, he does the Transformers.
You got the Touch. You got the power.
Well, you sound like Dirk Diggler when you're singing it.
Yeah. No, I'm not hung like Dirk Diggler, sorry.
But I just find it to be... So this is another curious thing that happened in the 90s, or I guess the early 2000s, where they put out a soundtrack. So they put out the soundtrack for Boogie Nights, which was great. And then they put out a volume 2 Boogie Nights.
There's actually a soundtrack actually a soundtrack that did that I'm going to mention later too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So yeah, I just thought it was interesting. Like, why not just do a double album? But anyway, the whole thing, Fooled Around and Fell in Love's on there. Mama Told Me Not to Come's on there by Three Dog Night. It's just a great solid soundtrack, and I think Boogie Nights is one of the best soundtracks around, bar none. And then Magnolia, he went and did something totally different. He got Amy Mann to pretty much write kind of the score, but it wasn't the score, it was all songs. I mean, there was a score in the movie, but then he got Amy Mann to write all these songs about the movie and then incorporated them into the movie. He's even in the dialogue in the movie, there's lyrics, like the characters speak lyrics that Amy Mann wrote in one of the songs in the movie.
Maybe she wrote the songs based on his dialogue.
Maybe. Yeah. But very, very cool idea. And I really dig it. I mean, that's another soundtrack I really love. And of course, every song on that soundtrack makes me think of that movie because they're so tied in.
Well, yeah, I think it's cool that there's not many directors out there who do actually compile their own soundtrack albums like that, like Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson does, because most of the time it just falls to a music supervisor not really tied into the script or whatever. And the only other instance I wanted to bring up about a director being involved in that sense is James Gunn and Guardians of the Galaxy, where he's made this balls to the wall, like special effects filled modern sci-fi movie, but put all these 70s songs on the soundtrack, like, you know, but a lot of repeats, like Fooled Around and Fell in Love is on there.
It's got 10
Hooked
CC,
on a Feeling.
Yeah, 10 CC's I'm Not in Love.
Yeah.
What's the other? Ooh Child, which I've been listening to all fucking day today now. Yeah. Ooh Child's on there from I think they're called the Five Stairs.
It's not like he just threw them in there. There is a purpose for them being there because
Cherry Bomb.
There is a purpose for them being there because the main character, Star-Lord, has a mixtape from his mother who dies at the beginning of the movie. And there's a cool scene at the beginning when he's going to search for an artifact on this alien planet, and he's dancing around and singing to Come and Get Your Love, and he's grabbing the alien creature and using it as a microphone. And, you know, it's just a really fun callback. And it's cool that he did these older songs in this modern sci-fi movie like that. Like, it made the tone of that movie automatically. You knew what you were getting.
Absolutely. And it was a masterful soundtrack. And those songs now are forever in my brain tied into that movie. And that is the way you got to get it done. And that, I can't say enough good about that, the way that James Gunn has incorporated 70s music. And it seems like 70s music seems to be a way to do it. Mm-hmm. He's hitting the nostalgia factor, but also, I guess, the songs.
Well, I mean,
we're better written.
The 70s were a great fucking decade for music.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s. I'm always going to have an affinity for 80s movies, music. But I realize that a lot of it's garbage.
Yeah.
I know the 70s was a better decade for music.
Well, I mean, we did have disco, but I mean, but some of these guys,
that was
though,
a brief flash in the pan, though.
But some of these guys have been able to incorporate fucking disco songs.
That's true.
I don't even like disco. But some of the songs I like because of the way they've been incorporated into a movie.
You know, if people want to impress me about incorporating disco songs into movies, someone's got to use I Was Made by Loving You by Kiss in a movie and make me fucking convinced that's a good song.
Well, it was kind of incorporated into Detroit Rock City, but not in a good way.
No, someone needs to incorporate that in a serious manner to try and convince me that that's a good song. I don't think it's going to happen.
No, not at all. So one other director that kind of did this, and with a little bit of help, but I'm just going to talk about two of his films. So David Lynch, mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about Wild at Heart, because I think he took some Elvis songs and was able to really incorporate them well, because he incorporated them into the whole story.
Well, due to the fact that Nicolas Cage's character is kind of like Elvis-y. Kind of. He's got the pompadour and shit and all that.
Exactly. But I mean, he did incorporate Love Me Tender and Love Me, two separate Elvis songs, into the plot of the movie. And also that the scenes where they are used are very memorable because Nick Cage sings them. He also incorporates the use of heavy metal quite well into the movie. In the opening scenes, Nick Cage basically goes crazy and like beats the shit out of this guy on the staircase.
Oh yeah, I remember that
scene. With this like metal song playing over by a band called Power Mad, which was really great. Also, Chris Isaak's Wicked Game was a huge fucking hit at the time, and Lynch was able to incorporate that into a very moody scene involving a car crash. And again, like when I think of Wicked Game, I think of Wild at Heart. I don't think of the video with that hot model in it on the beach.
Yeah.
Even though I just thought of it just then.
What I'm realizing from us talking is that we had different agendas going into our research for this, I think.
Maybe just different takes on soundtracks, right?
Right.
I mean, which is, I think, an interesting discussion in itself.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I wanted to bring up by Lynch is the Lost Highway soundtrack. Now, this is interesting because I haven't seen the movie, but I do own the soundtrack.
Well, that's got a lot of that. That's a lot of Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson.
Well, this is where... So Trent Reznor started getting into soundtrack stuff. Now, Trent Reznor has won fucking Oscars for soundtracks now because
Social Network.
Social Network, right. But I think this one or Natural Born Killers, but one of those two... Reznor did both of them.
Natural Born Killers came first.
That one came first. Mm-hmm. But Reznor was a really great creative director of a soundtrack. So he put the music together for the Lost Highway soundtrack and for Natural Born Killers.
Well, all I got to say about that is, good on you, Trent Reznor. You managed to get Red Right Hand by Nick Cave into a movie.
Which one was that in?
Natural Born.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, that song was also used quite effectively in Scream.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting. But, I mean, I'm at the time, I was really into Trent Reznor. I was really into Marilyn Manson. And I was really into David Lynch. So I bought the album.
That was your huge goth phase, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had a bit of a... Well, I don't know if I really had a goth phase.
Your pretend goth phase?
I don't know if it was pretend. I do like the genre. I like goth music.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'd ever say I was a goth just because I could never pull it off.
Back then, though, Marilyn Manson was really cool when he first started. And
first album?
Oh, yeah.
The first few albums. First,
up to Mechanical Animals, he was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, he's had some good albums.
Yeah. Now we're just shrugging our shoulders about Marilyn Manson.
No, I do like Marilyn Manson. You know, I don't like... One of the best concerts I've ever seen was Marilyn Manson.
With who?
I don't know. He wasn't playing with any... Like, I went to see Marilyn Manson this one night at this... It was quite a nice theater in Vancouver called the Orpheum Theater. I went and saw Marilyn Manson there, and then I walked out of there... Walked around the corner to the Commodore Ballroom and then went to a Cradle of Filth show the same
night. Jesus Christ.
That was a crazy ass night. But that was a good night, though. Anyway, back to Trent Reznor. So he was really with it with the soundtrack albums. Like, so I was able to buy the Lost Highway soundtrack and really enjoy it, having not seen the film. That's kind of my point. It's kind of touching on what you were saying, how a soundtrack album can be really great. Even if you can't incorporate it into the film. Because I still haven't seen Lost Highway. But I am able to enjoy the soundtrack. And it is very well put together, mixing genres. And I kind of like that when they mix genres like that.
Right.
Which Reznor was really good at doing. In Natural Born Killers and in Lost Highway. So, what did you want to bring up any other ones now?
Well...
You were starting to go down a bit of a path before I completely sidetracked
that's
the whole
okay.
Conversation.
I have two movies that I actually wrote down the soundtracks where these songs are in the movies. And they're both, I probably would call both of these my two favorite soundtracks of all time, actually.
Okay.
And the first one is This Is Spinal Tap.
Right, of course. Where
obviously the entire soundtrack is songs that were featured in the movie. They were either performed by the band or they were shown as a video clip by the band. And if you haven't seen Spinal Tap, you shouldn't be listening to this. You should be going and watching Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
It's a mockumentary about a rock band called Spinal Tap, an English rock band, played by Michael McKean, Christopher Guest, and Harry Shearer, directed by Rob Reiner, who also plays Marty DeBurgi, who's the filmographer of this documentary. And it's about them trying to do a comeback tour in America and failing miserably at it.
Yeah.
And it's got such memorable songs in it that I love. I crank out this soundtrack like at least twice a year.
It's a great fucking album by a fake band.
They're a fake band, but all their songs are awesome. You know, they have their Beatles-like song, Give Me Some Money.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got Big Bottom, which is my absolute favorite fucking song from the movie.
Yeah.
And I always walk around. Even I'll be at work and I'll just be, you know, doing whatever, and all of a sudden I'll just be like, Big Bottom,
yeah,
Big Bottom, talk about bum kicks, my girl's got them. And then there's the cool Tonight I'm Gonna Rock You song, which has a bridge in it where they're like, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, So, La, Di, Do.
Yeah.
And it's just fucking awesome. Like, these are actors.
Yeah.
And they managed to make this wicked album with these rock songs.
Yeah, it's a great
album. And it's like, there's some irony to it, but at the same time, you can tell they're taking this shit seriously.
Yeah.
And they actually managed to make two other albums, because they made Break Like the Wind
yeah.
in 1992, and then they made Back from the Dead in 2000, and I think it was 2008 or 7.
Mm.
And they re-recorded stuff for Back from the Dead, so that's why I didn't really care for it that much. But, I mean, this is Spinal Tap. Great fucking movie, great fucking soundtrack.
Totally.
That's just the way it goes. And the other movie that I wrote down, which is my absolute favorite soundtrack of all time, from one of my absolute favorite comedies of all time, is The Blues Brothers.
Right.
And this is the John Landis movie with Dan Aykroyd and Belushi.
Yeah.
Jim Belushi.
John Belushi.
John Belushi. Not yeah. Jim. Yeah. Fuck Jim. He was in the sequel. John Belushi, where they're two brothers, I guess, Elwood and Jake Blues,
yep.
who have a band, and they have to get the band together and try and save a orphanage. And it's great. It's got musical numbers from Aretha Franklin and James Brown and Ray Charles in it. And my absolute favorite musical number from a band that's not the Blues Brothers, Cab Calloway, doing Minnie the Moocher,
right?
Which actually made me go out and buy a Cab Calloway album.
Oh, really?
And this is, and this guy, he's a guy who's the swing band back in the 30s and 40s. Yep. Like, this is what he's known for. And for me to go into a store and buy a fucking swing CD that's like so far beyond what I usually buy, that's got to say something about the power of the Blues Brothers.
That's awesome, yeah.
And you know, and they also did their wicked, my two favorite songs are, Everybody Needs Somebody to Love,
yeah.
which is where they do at the big concert at the end when the cops are watching on, getting ready to arrest them, and they sneak out the bottom while they're doing a musical interlude.
Yeah.
And I love that song because it's got the audience interaction, and every time I hear it, it makes me smile.
Yeah, it's great.
Because it makes me think of the song. And then they do a really good version of She Caught the Katie, which is, I don't remember who does the original song, but it's the first song on the soundtrack, and the minute I hear that song, I'm like, I'm not turning this fucking album off.
Right on.
So, I mean, that's why Blues Brothers to me is my favorite soundtrack album, because I can listen to it all the way through and grin my way through that entire soundtrack.
Nice. Now, is that did the Blues Brothers have an actual album too?
They did make an actual album, and they did tour.
Mm-hmm.
And then they unfortunately decided to make a sequel.
Yeah, but after John Belushi was dead, like, yeah,
and they brought in his brother.
Yeah, and John Goodman.
And John Goodman, and
yeah,
no fucking thanks.
I always remember though. I guess my big thing from the Blues Brothers is Rawhide.
Yeah, Rawhide when they're in the
redneck bar,
in the redneck yeah. bar, and they're trying to play their regular music, and everyone's getting pissed off at them. So they're like, "Fuck, we gotta play something." So they're playing Rawhide, and it's so awesome just to see these guys decked out in their fedoras. Roll them up, Rawhide!
It's yeah, just it's pretty great.
Great movie. Great fucking, great car chase through a mall. Great fucking neo-Nazi laughs. I mean, how can you go wrong
great
with this movie?
Great fucking neo-Nazi.
Great fucking neo-Nazis. I bet you never thought you'd hear that on a podcast. But anyway.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to throw another one out.
Sure.
So I guess, so this is one of my favorite soundtracks. And this is, so this one's an odd one because it does I love fucking just listening to this album,
mm-hmm.
just because it's so well put together. But I also am able to tie every song into the movie.
Okay. I'm going to take a guess at what it is.
You're not going to get it.
I'm going to guess.
Guess.
Is it The Crow?
No.
Oh, I'm wrong. Fuck nope. me. Okay, nope. go ahead.
It's Pink Flamingos.
Really?
Yeah, it's okay. probably... Oh, I don't know. I've got a few on here that are could all be my favorite, but this is definitely probably the... I'd say this is the one I go back to the most.
That's an interesting choice because I honestly can't tie anything to Pink Flamingos, but... That might be because I haven't seen Pink Flamingos in at least 15 years.
Well, it's all over the place, but it's kind of all 50 Waters, stuff.
Of course it's all over the place.
You've got Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent.
Okay.
You've got Little Richard, The Girl Can't Help It, you know, and nothing like watching Divine when you're hearing your Little Richard
song. So what's the scene from the movie with that song?
She's just walking around.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's the Nighthawks, Chicken Grabber. There's The Surfing Bird by the Trash Men.
Oh, everybody's and heard about the bird.
You can't not think about Divine when you're hearing Patti Page's How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
Oh, yeah. Okay, now that you said that, that totally brings me back to Pink Flamingos.
Well, what are you thinking of? Obviously, yeah. You're thinking about shit eating is what you're thinking of.
Fuck, I gotta watch that movie
it's
again.
It's a really great soundtrack, and John Waters put together... Obvious. I mean, he's obviously a fan of this stuff, but I mean, fuck, this thing plays...
You can tell he's a fan of this stuff from Hairspray alone.
Yeah.
And but, Crybaby.
Yeah. But this plays so well, and I enjoy it every time I hear it. So, and it's probably the one soundtrack I pull out more than anything else. Hmm. So
Pink Flamingos is yours, my Blues Brothers.
You could say that. Hmm. Yeah.
Good.
So, yeah.
I want to talk about a soundtrack where I absolutely have no ties to the movie because I don't think most of the songs were in the fucking movie. But for some reason, I love the soundtrack. And it's a terrible movie that the soundtrack's for, too. It's Escape from L.A.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah, man.
Where did that come from?
The reason I love Escape from L.A. is this came out in 95. And this was like at the new... cusp of alternative acts and things like that, where I was starting to discover.
Never in my fucking wildest dreams would I have brought up Escape from L.A.
Well, there you go. I'm just going to quickly go over it. This is a soundtrack that had, you know, Tool on it. Okay. It had White Zombie, Ministry. It had Tori Amos.
Yeah.
And it had some bands that I had no idea who they were, but I heard a song on it and I went and bought their albums. There was a band called Clutch.
Okay.
Yeah. We did a song called Escape from the Prison Planet. They're still going strong. They're a great band. They're like groove metal.
Yep.
But they're very, very creative. And this was the song Escape from the Prison Planet. I went and bought their self-titled album because it was nice. On this soundtrack.
That's cool.
There was a band called Orange 9mm.
Okay.
Who did a song called Fire in the Hole. They're not around. They only did two albums, I believe. But they were former members of Gorilla Biscuits.
Okay.
Which was a hardcore New York punk band. And they were kind of a rap metal amalgamation. And I bought their album because of the soundtrack.
Nice.
There was the band Sugar Ray, who had a song called 10 Seconds Down. This is back when Sugar Ray actually played metal. This is before Fly came and they decided to change their entire sound and sell out like the fuckers they became.
Yeah.
But
they were a metal band?
They were a metal band for their first two albums.
Weird.
10 Seconds Down is a friggin' good metal song. The cover of the album is called Lemonade and Brownies.
Okay, I know.
And
the
it's
album
got
cover.
Nicole Eggert naked on the cover.
Sheridan.
Is it Sheridan?
Nicolette Sheridan.
I thought it was Eggert.
One of those high
Someone fact check and let us know. But anyway.
We'll figure that
great
out.
Great fucking album. Like, good album. This is when they were metal. And I bought that album because of Escape from L.A. It also has a song by the band Stabbing Westward, who were kind of like a gothy...
They were like kind of gothy like industrial. Yeah.
Yeah, and they had a song called Dawn on there, which actually uses John Carpenter's theme music for Escape from New York in the song.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
As part of the bridge. So this is why this soundtrack came up for me, because I hate the fucking movie.
Weird.
But that soundtrack is so awesome. I don't know why. I think it's because it introduced me to so much I didn't know. And that was like back in the day when you could just blind buy an album.
Yeah.
And if you didn't like it, return it to the store because there was no such thing as MP3s.
Right, right.
So great discovery. That's why I wanted to bring it up.
Well, it does actually make me think of, and you just guessed you thought I'd bring this up last time.
The Crow,
yeah. I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I've been thinking a lot about The Crow, and like, back in the day, I fucking loved the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't hold up for me now.
No, not really.
At all.
There's a lot of filler on there.
There is a lot of filler. But back in the day, same reasons. I mean, I discovered some new bands. My favorite song on the album is a song called Slip, Slide, Melting by a band called For Love Not Lisa, mm-hmm. that didn't really do much else. I think a few of the members became a Christian rock band or something after the fact. But I mean, it did, for that time, and I guess I was when I was kind of going through a bit of a goth phase. I mean, I was really into the movie. The movie totally connected with me.
The movie's still cool.
I haven't seen the movie in a long time, but I mean, the soundtrack, everyone fucking had that. Everyone in my group of friends was into that soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it had some cool things. It had Nine Inch Nails doing a Joy Division cover. It had the Rollins Band.
Ghost Rider.
Yeah, which was a song by a band called Suicide.
Didn't
a New
it
York
also
band.
Have Pantera doing a cover? The Badge? Isn't that a cover?
That's a cover by Poison Idea, punk rock band. Yeah. There was also a song called Time Baby 3 by a band called Medicine. I really dug that song. They were actually in the movie performing that song.
Oh, okay.
It had My Life with Thrill Kill Cult, who they were an interesting kind of goth band because they had some really good albums, and then they kind of went a little more disco-y, which was a really weird transition.
Sounds kind of KMFDM, kind of, in a way.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, they put out this album called Sexplosion, and they changed, but their albums before that were really cool. Anyway, they had a song on there. It had Rage Against the Machine. It had Stone Temple Pilots. It had Violent Femmes. So this album, and The Cure, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, The Cure and Joy Division were, you know, very influential on the original comic that James Zobar wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this was a kind of an alternative kind of super album at the time.
Yeah, if you look at those band names you just spit out,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, and so I know people really dug this album. Now, I haven't pulled it out in a long time. I don't know if I'd like it anymore. But certainly at that time, in the early 90s, I was all over this
thing. Yeah, it's not held up that great, actually. I listened to it not that long ago.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, and I just was like, well, there's still songs I like on here, but as a whole, it doesn't really gel.
Now, so these types of albums, so The Crow and the Escape from L.A., so this is what I was referring to earlier.
The music influenced by.
Exactly. So this was at a time when people were actually getting jobs putting together albums of up and coming artists, and somehow just trying to tie these artists and the songs
the most
into the
tenuous
film.
Loose ties you could get to a movie just because you wanted to get your band out there to try and give them the exposure. And I guess it fucking worked for us.
Well, exactly. And The Crow, I mean, other than that song that I mentioned, my Medicine, and I believe Thrill Kill Cult is also in the movie performing a song, but other than that, I can't really tie any of these songs into the movie.
Right.
So it's kind of like when we were talking about Tarantino, that's how I feel about the Crow soundtrack.
Right.
And it sounds like that's how you feel about the Escape
totally
from L.A.
Totally the way I feel about Escape from L.A. I can't remember any of these songs in the movie.
So it's interesting how we can have this love of this particular soundtrack, even though we can't really tie it into the movie. So it is, you know, I know you said we were going into this two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think because it's a bizarre topic, you know, in a way.
Right.
Like, just how the way things touch you, right? I mean, the way music touches you and the way films touch you. And, you know, we were talking about Paul Thomas Anderson stuff, and we're talking about the way those things are able to combine in a really cool way, you know, to where both are hitting you at the same time. It's a really special thing. But, you know, I think these things also can be separated.
Well,
well,
in a way, these influenced by and compilation ones that we're talking about, like Escape from LA, they're kind of special in their own roundabout way because they're also turning you on to these new bands.
And, absolutely.
If you're into movies, you have to be into music as well.
If you're as into movies as we are.
Yeah, like you have to be into music as well. And to discover these new bands in a roundabout way from something you really love, which is movies.
Yeah.
Is always just a cool thing in general. And the next one I wanted to bring up is kind of, I don't know that I don't remember any songs from this being in the movie, and I don't think they were. These just like there was this weird trend when this album came out, and this is the Judgment Night soundtrack.
I'm glad one of us brought this
and
up.
This is a weird trend because they decided it would be a good idea to take different genres of music and kind of slam them together.
Yeah.
And make a kind of a mashup soundtrack, I guess you'd call it these days. So, like, what they did with Judgment Night is they took a lot of alternative rock bands and mashed them up with rap artists.
Yeah.
And they made this soundtrack. So there was, like, you know, Helmet teaming up with House of Pain and Ice-T teaming up with Slayer and Cypress Hill and Pearl Jam making a song together and that. And, you know...
It's a cool idea.
It's a cool idea. Yeah. And I actually really like the Judgment Night soundtrack. I like the song... Another Body Murdered by Helmet and Faith No More and Booyah Tribe. I'm not looking at my notes, so I'm fucking up. Let me just grab my book. And it's got Mudhoney and Sir Mix-a-Lot doing Freak Mama. And it's cool because it's these bands where you wouldn't expect them to do a song together doing it.
Yeah.
I don't honestly remember any of these songs being in the movie, but because the movie is about kind of the urban and the, you know, suburban clashing together.
Perfect.
It's kind of a good analogy for the soundtrack in a way. And they did try and do this again in 2007 or six. I think it was six Spawn. When they did the Spawn soundtrack where they mashed techno acts with rock acts together. And I found that wasn't nearly as successful as Judgment Night was.
No, I used to have that CD and I actually got rid of it, which, you know, is a feat for me. So.
And I really do love the Judgment Night soundtrack. I can't explain to you why.
Yeah.
I just find it to be an interesting experiment that worked.
Totally. And I mean, again, and it ties into what we were just talking about with, you know, soundtracks being born of a musical supervisor or whatever, sort of trying to, you know, use a movie as a promotional tool for bands. And, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I used to own the Spawn soundtrack. Judgment Night, I know about it, I've heard it, but I've never actually owned it.
Right.
But I did, you know, it was a cool take on things, but I don't really have a tie to either of those two. But
I was listening to Judgment Night today, actually, before we started, and I listened to the Slayer and Ice-T song.
Right.
And then I realized that this was around the same time that Ice-T was had launched Body Count. So I'm like, well, this makes perfect friggin' sense.
Shit, we're
going to
go
now,
on a big tangent right now, are we?
No, we're not going on a tangent. I'm not going on a Body Count tangent. Don't worry. I just thought it made sense to me more than it did when the soundtrack first came out. Now, looking back on it, because he was trying to launch Body Count and they teamed him up with Slayer.
It makes sense,
And it actually kind of worked.
Yeah. No. So... Body Count. Anyway, we'll leave.
Body Count. Body Count. Body Count. Yeah, motherfucker. Anyway.
Okay. Well, while we're on the topic of this sort of like manufactured soundtrack thing, I would like, I'll just bring up a couple more. I thought the Tank Girl soundtrack was pretty good as well. For the same reason, though, like, I can kind of tie in Army of Me by Bjork into the movie because I know that was a shower scene. I can certainly tie up Paul Westerberg and Joan Jett teaming up to do Cole Porter's Let's Do It because I know that was the big sort of musical scene. But it also had, you know, it had Portishead. It had Devo, Girl You Want. It had Hole. So it was a pretty good – I had L7 – pretty good soundtrack, but again, don't know how much the filmmaker was actually thinking about putting these bands in.
Funny thing about the Army of Me is that I don't understand Bjork's appeal because I don't really care for her, but I fucking love Army of Me. And it's because of that soundtrack that I do.
It's a good fucking song. And actually, I think I just screwed up. It wasn't, I don't think it was Army. I don't think it was Bjork in the shower scene. I think it was the Portishead song, but anyway.
Way to go. Yeah, I thought you had your new, you're like my version of Mr. Skin and you screwed up.
I'm so tired right now, dude. Like I've already explained this to you before we started recording.
I'm exhausted right now.
I fuck up, I'm sorry, people. But I'm pretty sure it's Portishead. Anyway, so there you go. So if you were going to say I fucked up there, I just corrected myself.
Way to go.
So just a couple more on this topic. Love in a 45, I thought, also was a pretty decent soundtrack. Kind of an obscure movie.
Yeah, I know. I've seen the movie, but I don't recall anything about the actual soundtrack.
The soundtrack opened up with Turn It On by the Flaming Lips, which is probably the best opening song to any album ever. It also had Mazzy Star on it. It had a really good cover of Nazareth's Love Hurts, which I actually don't know if Nazareth wrote that. Anyway.
They didn't. It's Nazareth's Love Hurts is actually a cover.
Yeah. But anyway, it's a cover of that song by Kim Deal from the Pixies and Robert Pollard from Guided by Voices. They get together and do a cover of.
Oh, and by the way, I can't give you too much shit about not knowing "Love Hurts" is a cover because I didn't know about it till about 6 months ago myself.
Well, I did know it was a cover. I just don't know who it was a cover by. I'll probably think of it if I keep thinking. And it also another song that I can place. In the movie is the Butthole Surfers, who was in my room last night. A great driving scene, but I remember
that's a perfect song for a driving scene.
I clearly remember that song playing and them all, just kind of a one shot of these three characters in this driving scene. And then another one that sort of was in this cash-in phase was the Pump Up the Volume soundtrack.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, but then I decided to omit it.
It was a really good soundtrack with, again, a lot of bands from that kind of early 90s alternative.
I liked the Everybody Knows Leonard Cohen cover by Concrete Blonde, but I love Concrete Blonde, so that's why.
Yeah, and I really liked, there was an Ivan Neville song, which I wouldn't think I would be.
Yeah, and that's from the scene in the movie when Christian Slater and Samantha Mathis are first looking at each other and taking their clothes off and about to make out. It fit the movie
so
perfectly.
Good, yeah.
The one song that's not on the soundtrack and Pump Up the... Actually, I think it is on the soundtrack, is Wiener Schnitzel by the Descendants.
I don't know. It's not on the soundtrack.
It's not on the soundtrack, but it's my favorite part of
the
movie.
The Hello, Dad, I'm in Jail thing? Or
no, that's Was Not Was.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's the...
That's not on the soundtrack either.
Welcome to the Wiener Schnitzel. What can I get you? Yeah, rah, 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 rah. Want whale sperm with that? No! That's like one of the greatest scenes in Pump Up Volume. I love fucking Pump Up Volume. Yeah. I could talk about Pump Up the Volume for like half an hour if you started me on that route, but we're not going to.
No.
Also got that Bad Brains, Henry Rollins, Kick Out the Jams cover on it.
Yeah, the MC5 cover, and it's got Soundgarden, Sonic Youth, the Cowboy
Junkies. That Sonic
Youth
song's awesome.
Yeah, it's got a really good, it's got a decent Peter Murphy song, and the one that was most notable at the time for me was the Pixies. It was their,
Wave Mutilation.
Yeah, the UK Surf. So you could only get... Like, Wave Mutilation was a song on the Doolittle album, but they slowed it down dramatically in Pump Up the Volume, and it was such a good version of the song, but it was the only way you could get that version was to buy the soundtrack from Pump Up the Volume.
I have that soundtrack on CD to this day, man.
So do I. It's a good soundtrack, but it was, again, in that time where there was a musical director.
But they did use a lot of those songs in the movie.
Because the movie was so musical. I'm surprised that didn't come up in our rock and roll episode.
The most bizarre song on that soundtrack is I've Got a Secret.
Yeah, the Peter Murphy camera. Song. Peter Murphy from Bauhaus. Yeah.
So weird.
It was weird. Yeah.
Another soundtrack that's kind of like the musical director soundtrack, right. But they did incorporate some of these songs in the movie, was Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Which I harassed you for months and months to give me your CD of that.
Yeah.
And they did use some of the songs in the movie. Like, they used Kiss's cover of God Gave Rock and Roll to You in the movie. But this was interesting because it was like on the cusp of hair metal going out and alternative metal coming in. So you had your hair metal bands like Winger and Slaughter on the soundtrack, but you also had bands like Primus.
Yeah.
And you had Megadeth doing Go to Hell.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting song because it starts with the Lord's Prayer in it. And it came out around the same time as Metallica's Enter Sandman. So there's so many parallels there's so many parallels you can put between that, like who ripped off who there. Dave Mustaine, was he pissed off at Metallica for kicking him out of the band way back in the 80s that he fucking copied them? Or did Metallica copy fucking Megadeth? Who knows, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a really cool Faith No More song called The Perfect Crime.
Yeah.
Which has not appeared on any of their albums. And it's like a great fucking song because Faith No More is my favorite band of all time, as I've said before. But that's like one of my favorite songs of theirs.
It's great.
And it's just a really good soundtrack. And it's just interesting because, you know, it's totally musical directed.
Yeah.
And it's just, I found it interesting because it's like I said, it's going from the hair metal's on its way out The alternative metal's on its way in. They're meeting in the middle. They're having sex. They're shitting out Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Well, it's true. And it's and actually, my favorite song on that soundtrack is Showdown by Love on Ice, which was kind of a hair metal band.
Right, right.
So they were like really straddling that shit. But I don't remember that song from the movie at all. But it's a
straddling.
Really, it's a good fucking song.
Wow.
All right, so are we done with the musical director shit?
There's one more.
Okay.
And I'm gonna really gloss this over quick, and it's Wes Craven's Shocker. And this is an album I was looking for forever.
Wow.
And then when I finally got it, I realized it's really not that good. Although,
yeah, I would imagine. I did think of this during when I was thinking about this episode, but I just although didn't
there, the only thing I wanted to mention was there was two songs in it called Shocker and Shock Dance by a band called the Dudes of Wrath. And this was a super group that consisted of Paul Stanley, Desmond Child, Alice Cooper, Tommy Lee, Rudy Sarzo, and others.
Oh my God.
Shocker is the theme song for the movie, and it's mostly sung by Paul Stanley. And it's got that horrible chorus, Shocker! Shocker! We're led like lambs to the slaughter! But then it's got Shock Dance, which tops everything else on that fucking album, because it's Alice Cooper and Mitch Pileggi, who played Horace Pinker, rapping. And Mitch Pileggi is fucking rapping in character.
Mitch Pileggi, like the guy from X-Files?
Yes.
Really?
He's Shocker.
Mitch Pileggi is Shocker?
He's Horace Pinker.
Oh my, like...
You didn't know that
Skinner
shit?
From X-Files? Yes. Fuck, I didn't know that.
Well, now you gotta watch Shocker, don't you?
Oh, yes, I do.
But he raps in character.
Wow.
Very, very bizarre.
I'm totally watching that again now. Maybe I knew that somewhere, but I had no idea.
This song on it by this band called Dead On, who only put out one album. And I remember loving the song when it first came out. It's called A Different Breed. But then when I got the soundtrack again all these years later, I realized it's fucking terrible.
Wow.
So that's all I got to say about Shocker.
Shocker. Well, you have to remind me later. We need to put that on the Facebook page or something. That
I already put the Shock Dance one on the Video Graveyard's Facebook page today.
I'm going to have to put that on the Twitter or something. Okay, so trying to get us out of this musical director bullshit now, I am going to bring up one that questionably was musical directed, but I don't know if it was, and that was a soundtrack for Singles, because that was another...
I don't think it was musical director. I think Cameron Crowe must have had something to do with
it. But it did feel like kind of that, because it was all those bands were really hot at the time.
Well, the movie's about grunge music.
True,
though.
But... Still, I don't know.
Okay, go on.
So anyway, Singles, this is another soundtrack that at the time, kind of like The Crow, everyone fucking had it.
Yeah, even me.
And yes, the movie was based on the grunge scene. It was based in Seattle. So we had all kinds of good songs on there. Alice in Chains was on there, Pearl Jam. The Love Mongers, who was Heart with Alice in Chains together.
Okay.
So another super group. You had Mother Love Bone doing... Crown of Thorns, Soundgarden, Mudhoney, Jimi Hendrix, Screaming Trees, for whatever fucking reason, because they're not from Seattle, the Smashing Pumpkins, which does kind of lead me to believe it was sort of musically directed. And then there was a couple of weird Paul Westerberg songs that I kind of liked, but a lot of people skipped those too.
What was the Smashing Pumpkins song, do you know?
I can't remember what it was called.
That is weird that they'd be on a grunge album, because I never associated them with grunge.
Oh, I kind of associated them with with those bands, but they weren't from Seattle. I mean, like every other band, even Jimi Hendrix is from fucking Seattle, so I don't know why Smashing Pumpkins are on the scene.
I like Siamese Dream and Gish, but... Why are they on that soundtrack?
Well, and why is Paul Westerberg on there? Because
probably makes less sense than Smashing Pumpkins.
Because the Mats were from Minneapolis, I believe. But so I don't know why Paul Westerberg was on there. Anyway, it's an interesting soundtrack. But again, I used to listen to this shit all the time, but not so much anymore.
Well, one of the ones that I'm pretty sure wasn't musically directed in a sense, because the movies were used a lot in the movie, was Gross Point Blank.
I don't know.
A lot of the songs were used in the movie in the sense that he was going to his high school reunion.
Yeah.
And that's a great soundtrack.
It's got its moments.
It's got the Clash.
It's got some good stuff, yeah.
It's got the Clash. It's got the Violent Femmes, the Jam. It's got the Specials.
It's got Grandmaster Flash.
Yep. That's on the more Gross Point Blank. Okay. And it's got my favorite song on both soundtracks is Sushi and the Banshees doing Cities of Dust.
Yeah.
Which is fucking amazing.
Yeah, it's again, I didn't like the movie at all. So. Yeah,
well, I like the movie, and I think it's interesting that in that time frame, John Cusack, when he did Gross Point Blank and High Fidelity kind of back to back, the soundtracks just felt like something the characters would be listening to me.
Yeah.
To me.
I get that.
I mean, because, you know, there was Pressure Drop and, you know, English Beat doing Mirror in the Bathroom,
yeah,
and all that. And I just think the Gross Point Blank, those two soundtracks are really cool.
Yeah, and again, like kind of like the Tarantino discussion, I think had I connected with the movie more, I mean, because I love all the songs, but I mean, I've got all those albums, right?
Right.
So I've got
I think it's definitely a good gateway for people who aren't into the UK.
If you weren't
punk
into, yeah.
Alternative scene and like Violent Femmes and stuff, because a lot of people discovered Violent Femmes because of Blister in the Sun being on that soundtrack.
No, I totally agree with that. It's a good gateway, but like if you've been familiar with that music all your life, it's kind of like, eh. Well, it's an okay compilation.
That's the way I'm looking at it, is that I'm looking at that more as a gateway, because even the second album, the more Gross Point Blank, like you said, it had White Lines. I said it has Cities and Dust. It also has Monkey Gone to Heaven by the Pixies.
Yeah.
And if you don't know the Pixies by the time that movie came out, it's a great gateway.
No, fair enough. And I think had I liked the movie more, I would have liked the soundtracks a lot more. It just didn't connect with me whatsoever. But absolutely, you're totally right. Gateway, totally. Another one like that's kind of like that with the same style of music would be, this is a really obscure film that maybe a lot of people don't
more
know.
More obscure than Love in a 45?
Maybe. It's a film called Whatever from 1999.
See, even I don't know this shit. Well, and you don't usually get to stump me that often, so you know.
It's a movie, it was made in the late 90s. It's about growing up in the early 80s. It's directed by a woman named Susan Skook.
Now, is it from the title, I'm going to just make an assumption about the plot. Now, is it punk rock based?
Kind of. Like, it's about just about a young teenage girl just going through teenage shit, right?
Right.
But you're right. It's got a great, like, punk rock soundtrack from that time, like, kind of post-punk as you used earlier.
Right.
It's got the Pretenders.
Motherfucking post-punk.
It's got the Ramones. It's got Susie and the Banshees. It's got Patti Smith. It's got Blondie. It's got the Jam.
Sounds like
the Jam was
freaking
everything.
Sweet soundtrack
to
me.
It's got the Stooges. It's got the Cramps. I mean, it's a fucking awesome soundtrack.
Any soundtrack that has the Cramps automatically wins.
Yeah. So it's, again, a really, really good one for that.
Do you have this soundtrack?
I do. Oh. But if you're looking for that, and I've seen the movie too. Huh. But if you're looking for stuff like as a gateway to that genre, like that style of music, another really great one, because it's just all these songs are really good. And if maybe you've heard Blondie, maybe you've heard The Hardest Part by Blondie, but you've never heard In the City by The Jam. I don't know where I first heard In the City by The Jam, but that fucking song changed my life. Mm-hmm. And once you've heard it, like, you can't go back, right? So having a compilation of all that type of music is really great. You know, and that's why I really dig it when people can get it right. And that Whatever soundtrack gets it right.
Well, that's interesting, because I just had a thought flitter through my brain about one-off songs from soundtracks that I thought were really cool. And for some reason, there's this 1994 movie called SFW starring Stephen Dorff and Reese Witherspoon. And the only thing I can honestly remember about that soundtrack now is the Guar song So Fucking What, because it's unreleased on any albums and I used to fucking play it endlessly when I had that soundtrack.
Nice. I never owned that soundtrack. I really wanted to like that movie. I just didn't dig it as much as I
thought. I just recently rebought it on DVD for like $2 just because I want to see if I actually will like it now.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting, like, nihilistic kind of fight the power kind of movie, and I really am curious to see how it held up.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's that.
Another pretty good punk rock soundtrack that's kind of a classic is the soundtrack for Repo Man.
Yeah, that's
Are you familiar with that one? Yeah. Because that one's got Black Flag on it doing TV Party. It's got Suicidal Tendencies doing Institutionalized. It's got the Circle Jerks doing a couple songs. They do Coup d'Etat, and then they also do a kind of a loungy version of When the Shit Hits the Fan.
I'm sold on Institutionalized.
Yeah, there's a few songs by The Plugs, who are like kind of a Latino band, I believe. And then there was Let's Have a War by Fear. But it's another pretty good soundtrack. But I think it would probably be on a lot of people's top 10 lists, but not mine. But it's a good one. It's definitely good. It's just not one that I go back to often again, because again I have the Black Flag.
Was any of those people from the soundtrack in the actual movie though? Because that was a very punk rock movie.
I think Leaving.
Was Leaving in the movie?
Leaving was in
because
the movie.
I know he did a little bit of acting in the mid 80s.
We both just sort of jumped out like, oh yeah, I think Leaving was in it. So I feel like he was in the movie.
Because he was in that Nightmares anthology flick I watched recently. And I was like, now you're saying Repo Man and I see Fears on the soundtrack. I'm thinking maybe he's in the movie too.
Yeah.
Because Alex Cox was really punk rock in that Repo Man. The entire movie was really punk rock. So
it was. I mean, it was a good movie, but you know, and it's a great soundtrack. It's again, just not one that I go out. It's not like the Pink Flamingos one that I'm pulling it out quite often.
Right.
This one I'll go back to once in a while, but I already have the Black Flag album. I already have the Suicidal Tendencies album. I already have the Circle Jerks albums. Right. I already have the Fear album. Like, why would I go and...
True.
You know, I'd rather listen to the Suicidal Tendencies album, right? But that's another pretty good one.
So I really don't have any more actual soundtracks. Do you have any? Because I thought...
I
thought that we could start heading towards what we were talking about at the beginning about actual moments.
Sure. There's one more I'd like to bring up.
Okay.
Just because, actually, there's two more.
Okay.
Actually, there's a few more.
Just spit them.
Okay. So the first one that I'd like to bring up is Velvet Goldmine, the Todd Haynes film.
You've brought this movie up in the past, too.
It's a good fucking movie. Yeah. But because it's about Bowie and it's about Iggy Pop. But the soundtrack's really cool because, I mean, it's combining... it's combining different periods of music. So you're combining the newer music of the 90s with the 70s glam rock scene.
Right.
And it's again, really well put together. So on a soundtrack that has Placebo, Pulp, and Elastica and the Teenage Fan Club, you've also got Roxy Music, Lou Reed, and T-Rex and Brian Eno.
Hmm.
But another thing that happens, and this is another one that has one of these super groups in it, where you've got Tom York and Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead with Andy McKay from Roxy Music, and then you've got Bernard Butler from Suede and Paul Kimball from Grant Lee Buffalo getting together and doing glam rock songs.
Huh.
So great movie and another great soundtrack, and I do go back to this one quite often as well. Another one I'd like to bring up with as far as punk rock goes is the Return of the Living Dead soundtrack.
Of course.
We touched on the movie earlier, or we touched on part two earlier.
Which doesn't have a soundtrack like part one.
But this is another one, and I do, again, go back to this one. I do listen to this one fairly regularly, even though I do own most of the stuff. But it opens up with the Cramps, and then you've got TSOL, you've got 45 Grave, you got the Flesh Eaters. You got Rocky Erickson, who was in the 13th Floor Elevators and doing a great song that, again, if we're talking about songs, placing in movies, Rocky Erickson's Burn the Flame in Return of the Living Dead. Of course, you're thinking of James Caron climbing into the cremation chamber.
Well, just like I'm thinking when you talk about 45 Grave, I'm thinking about zombies time, popping out of the grave.
Yep.
Do you want to party?
Yeah, 45 Grave, Dinah Cancer is the singer. I've always loved that name.
And like I said before, any soundtrack that has the Cramps is an instant win.
And it's also got the Damned on it. And the weak point is a band called SSQ doing the Tonight We'll Make Love Till We Die. Not a particularly big fan of the song. However, again, I can place it in the movie because that's when Linnea's doing her grave dance.
I was thinking before when you were talking about that that movie, the 1999 movie I've never heard of. I'm afraid.
Whatever.
I was trying to think of. I thought of a movie that has a song in it that really means something to me, and it's not particularly because of the movie. It's just because I place the song with the movie, no matter what, whenever I hear it. And I couldn't remember it for the longest time, and it just popped back in my head. And it's "Surrender" by Cheap Trick in the movie, the 1979 movie "Over the Edge."
Nice.
Which, if you have not seen that movie, it's pretty fucking rad.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Because it's one of those teen angst movies where all the bored kids. they go and take over a rec center because they're bored and their parents are not paying attention to them, and they cause fucking havoc.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. Great movie.
Yeah, it's
and I
a good
just
movie.
Every time I hear Surrender by Cheap Trick, I think of that movie.
I love that shit, man. There's only one other main soundtrack I'd like to bring up. Well, no, actually, there's two more. But so the first one is I'm going super fucking obscure now, but this is one I really connected
with.
Way
to go, man.
This is another one I really connected with when I was a kid or when I was a teenager. It was a shot in Vancouver punk rock movie called Terminal City Ricochet.
Okay.
And I don't think it's ever been released properly, but the soundtrack has been, I believe. The only reason I know about this movie is because I know my aunt was originally asked to do costume design on this movie, and she turned it down. I don't know why. What the fuck? But but this...
you should go slap her.
So it was a punk rock movie. It had Jello Biafra in it. It had DOA in it. It was shot here in Vancouver. But the soundtrack was great because, yeah, it had DOA on it. It had No Means No on it. No Means No is a great band from Victoria. It had a band called the Grooveaholics with a great song called Pull the Trigger Sunshine. It had Jerry Hanna, a.k.a. Jerry Useless, doing a acoustic song called Living with the Lies. And then it had a few songs. It had a Jello Biafra teaming up with No Means No song and a Jello Biafra teaming up with DOA song. So, again, another really great, great Vancouver punk rock soundtrack.
I have a funny story about No Means No and the fact that I love No Means No, but the reason I love No Means No is because of a tribute album.
Which one?
Virus 100, yeah. The Dead Kennedys tribute album.
Yeah.
The fact that they had the balls to do Forward to Death in a cappella made me love that band for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's a great, 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 great song. Just a couple more. Valley Girl, again, another really great post-punk soundtrack. Now, not quite as good as some of the other ones I've mentioned, but it does have the Plimsolls on it. There's a couple songs by the Plimsolls. One's called A Million Miles Away, which they actually perform in the club in the movie. Fun fact, the club in the movie is the Viper Room. That's a real high point of this soundtrack for me. I do like going back to this one quite a bit as well. There's also a few songs by Josie Cotton, another kind of obscure-ish punk
Johnny,
rock singer.
Johnny, are you queer?
Johnny, are you queer? Yep, great. And then she has a couple more songs on the soundtrack as well. It's also got the, you know, Modern English's I Melt With You, which, you know, if you've seen the movie, you know that's the, what do you call it, like the... Montage sequence when they're falling in love. Men at Work, the Paolas. It's another really good one. I can't do a soundtrack album episode without mentioning Purple Rain.
Probably
gonna get shit again.
Purple Rain.
But it does. Again.
Okay. Quick quiz. Best song on Purple Rain soundtrack. Go.
Beautiful Ones.
Mm. Darling Nikki, motherfucker.
Yeah, and Beautiful Ones. Hands down.
No, I like Darling Nikki so much that I even like the cover by Foo Fighters.
Yeah. Have you heard there's another cover where Rebecca Romijn does it?
Really?
Yeah, it's on one of those, like, Cleopatra Records tribute albums.
I gotta hear this.
Yeah, I've got it somewhere.
I have to go to YouTube later.
Yeah. Rebecca Romijn. Yeah, I think it might be just her. Okay,
I give you shit about Purple Rain, the movie.
Yeah.
But I will never give you shit about the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's a good soundtrack,
man. I mean, come on, Let's Go Crazy.
Yeah.
Come on.
It was Prince's, the high point of his career,
Let's
in
Go
my
Crazy
opinion.
Has one of the best fucking guitar solos ever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not gonna give you shit about that soundtrack.
And it's also got When Doves Cry.
That's true.
No bass.
Yeah. No bass.
Okay, and the
Geddy
other...
Lee would be very sad.
Who?
Geddy Lee would be sad.
The other one I'd like to mention is from a movie called The Harder They Come, which starred Jimmy Cliff.
Jimmy Cliff.
Yeah, and this is a movie that was shot in Kingston, Jamaica.
That's a great soundtrack.
In the 70s. And yeah, it's a great soundtrack that features not only Jimmy... I mean, you've got some great Jimmy Cliff songs. You've got Many Rivers to Cross, which is a fucking classic. We've got The Harder They Come, which is the theme song for the movie. You can get it if you really want it. I mean, again, these movies tie in, or some of these songs tie in, because in the movie, Jimmy Cliff's sort of playing himself as like a reggae singer trying to make it, trying to get out of like poverty and trying to become a reggae singer in Jamaica in the time period. It was shot under really harsh conditions, and it's really cool the way he incorporates himself into the plot and into the soundtrack. It's also got some other really great reggae artists. The Maytels doing Pressure Drop, which is a famous reggae song.
Yep.
Desmond Decker doing Shantytown.
Covered by the Specials on Gross Point Blank, Pressure Drop was.
Yeah, so it's a really great soundtrack. Also, if you're into reggae, just, I don't know, again, going a little more obscure, I'd like to bring up a movie called Rockers, which also has a fucking awesome soundtrack. And it's got Inner Circle on it. It's got Peter Tosh doing Step and Razor. It's got Junior Mervin doing Police and Thieves. So Clash fans, if you want to hear the original version of Police and Thieves, check it out. It's also got Bunny Wailer, Burning Spear, Third World. So all these like really great reggae bands are on this soundtrack. And it's so reggae fans, both those, they kind of go hand in hand, the Rocker soundtrack and the Harder They Come soundtrack. So highly recommend both of those if you're looking for something a little different than just plain old rock and roll.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes a little break from rock and roll is a good thing.
Yeah.
Why don't we start heading towards our wrap up? But first, let's just do a quick rundown of some...
I don't want this topic to songs. End, man. I still got so much shit to talk about.
But why don't we just talk about now? We'll talk about songs that are in movies that we thought were really effective, but we particularly don't want to mention the soundtracks of those movies.
Totally, yeah. Let's do
that. So let's start with that. I mean, I can kick that off. When you brought this up to me earlier today, because we had kind of talked about the topic, but you wanted to clarify if I wanted to touch on that, and I had nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I can do it. I've got some time. And I just quickly went through my collection, looked at what I had, and I came up with about 10 things that I wanted to mention. So let's start off. Let's start with Zombieland, which is one of the newer movies where they had that credit sequence where everything was slow motion and it was funny and it had the zombie with its stripper tassels and running after little girls and stuff, and they used For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah, classic.
By Metallica.
Perfect, yeah.
It was a great use of the song, and I love that credit sequence, and that's one of the ones that I instantly thought of when you brought this up, that we wanted to touch on this a little bit.
Great.
Another one, which I'll do real quick because it kind of ties in, is the...
Throw in a bunch,
2004 Dawn of the Dead remake,
mm-hmm.
where the same thing, they had a credit sequence where it was showing clips of the zombie apocalypse happening and everything, and it was set to When the Man Comes Around by Johnny Cash, mm-hmm. which is really, truly one of the last great original songs he wrote before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's a great song and it fits perfectly with that movie because it's such an apocalyptic movie. And When the Man Comes Around is about basically Jesus coming back and claiming everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's great.
Nice.
That's it. That's really, it's really surprising that we really don't have anything horror much that we've talked about. And there's those two, but even for my scenes here that I have written down, the only other horror movie I have down, and it's very loosely a horror movie, is Bad Channels from 1992.
Whoa.
The Charlie Band.
Yeah.
One. And the scene in that is a band called Psychotic Symphony doing a song called I'm So Happy. And it's a bizarre, guar-like band where they all wear masks. The guitar player's dressed like a nun. The singer has a clown mask on but is wearing a cow outfit with udders. And they're singing about being depressed and happy flowers all the time. And it's in the movie, and I fucking love it, and I can't explain to you why. They put out an album called Eargasm.
Weird, man.
That you can,
I thought I was being the most obscure person.
That you cannot find anywhere.
Wow.
But it's a sweet. It's like, it's the only reason I watch Bad Channels, because it's not really that great a movie.
Right on. Okay, I've got a number of, of course.
You've got more than me, man.
Got so many.
I saw your notes today.
Sorry,
and
dude.
Like, I'm like, hey, man, I have 4 pages. You're like, I got 12. I'm like, fuck you.
Okay. Okay, so let's run down just a few of these, just because, I'm hoping they'll bring up memories for people, or you'll be able to relate to me, sort of. And now there's some obvious ones. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody and Wayne's World.
Of course.
That's kind of like totally fucking iconic. Old time rock and roll and Risky Business.
Of course, this is
what we're talking about. Like, where you're just completely associating that song with
the
scene.
Minute you hear this song come on the radio or wherever, you're instantly clicking back to this movie memory, and that's exactly what we're going for with this little section here.
Yeah. Another one that's really struck me that way is Tiny Dancer by Elton John
from Almost Famous. Yep.
Like, again, I can't not think of Almost Famous when I hear that song now.
Well, yeah, and then we were talking earlier about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, because I have Moving in Stereo by The Cars, because it's the scene where he's fantasizing about Phoebe Cates and the pool, which obviously, from my hormonal state when back in 1983 when I would have saw it, that's awesome. You had said something about there was a Fast Times song, too.
The Jackson Browns, Somebody's Baby. That's when Jennifer Jason Leigh's character Stacy is about to get it in the dugout.
Yeah, but so, you see, I mean, like, these are songs, right, that are totally fitting perfectly with the films. Another one from the 80s that I really love, and it's a cheesy reason for this one, is in the 1985 John Cusack movie Better Off Dead, written and directed by Savage Steve Holland, they do Everybody Wants Some by Van Halen to a claymation fucking hamburger.
Nice.
And it's the best thing ever, because it's got a hamburger playing Eddie Van Halen's guitar, singing in David Lee Roth's voice, Everybody Wants Some. It's awesome.
Right on. Yeah, I haven't seen that in a long time. I've got a couple of Sam Cooke songs I'd like to bring up. The first one is Blue Moon, the Sam Cooke version, which is very famously used in American Werewolf in London in the transformation sequence.
Yep.
Another great use of a Sam Cooke song was in Witness, the song Wonderful World.
I've never seen that movie. I've heard it's really good.
It's a really good
movie.
That's
the Harrison Ford one, right?
Yeah. So it's a scene where Harrison Ford's romancing Kelly McGillis. And again, can't think of that song without thinking of that scene.
Right.
American Girl in Silence of the Lambs, Tom Petty song. That's the song that the girl's listening to. She's driving, and she's, I think, the first victim that the Buffalo Bill gets in the
bus. Wouldn't we also have to group in Goodbye Horses in Silence of the Lambs?
We would.
Because not only was that so memorable in Silence of the Lambs, Kevin Smith made fun of that in Clerks 2 by having Jay putting it on his boombox and pretending that he's in Silence of the Lambs, like tucking and saying, "Would you want to fuck me? I want to fuck me." And speaking of Clerks 2, I wanted to mention ABC by the Jackson 5, because there's that whole song and dance sequence in the middle of Clerks 2 that's so seemingly random that you would never think of in a Kevin Smith movie, that I just thought was a lot of fun. Plus, it gave me the opportunity to watch Rosario Dawson jiggle, so I wasn't complaining.
Nice. And you also mentioned a boombox in that little discussion there, so we can't really pass this section by without mentioning In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel.
Most definitely.
And Say Anything.
The funny thing about In Your Eyes is I love Say Anything. It's like probably my favorite 80s romantic comedy in a way. But it's like a romantic comedy for guys, too. That's the way I looked at it. And the funny thing about that, the story about that is Cameron Crowe was originally not going to use that song.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember what song they had originally queued up, but they talked to Peter Gabriel about maybe using the song in the movie, and he was like, "No, you can't," right? And because he had watched another movie that it was sent to him about using one of his songs, and he got it confused with Say Anything.
Oh, no.
So he said, "No, you can't use my song." But then when he saw Say Anything and saw where they wanted to use the song, he's like, "Yes, go ahead."
Oh,
so
nice.
I think that's a pretty funny story about that.
That's great. A couple more. Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus at the beginning of The Hunger.
Right.
It's kind of the opening sequence.
Speaking of David Bowie.
Yeah.
Magic Dance and Labyrinth.
Yeah, I knew you'd bring that
dance,
shit up.
Magic dance, magic dance. How could you not?
Yeah, that's true.
David Bowie and a codpiece throwing a baby around with a bunch of Jim Henson trolls. Awesome.
Well, yeah, David Bowie's all over the place, too.
Well, I mean, David Bowie's fucking the
we
best.
We could also bring up that Cat People song, too.
Right. David Bowie's awesome.
I also thought I'd bring up the Champs' use of tequila in Pee-wee's Big
Hell
Adventure.
Hell yeah, you would. I was doing that Pee-wee Herman dance at work the other day.
Nice.
And I have two more that I wanted to mention, and then you can go on your spiel of lists, because I'm assuming you've got way more than me.
I've got some more, yeah.
There's a 1994 movie called PCU,
right,
which I've mentioned in the past is one of my favorite 90s comedies, even though no one's seen it.
Yeah.
Starring Jeremy Piven.
Yeah.
And directed by Hart Bochner, who used to be an actor. I can't quite remember what he was in.
Die Hard.
Die Hard, okay. There was a scene in it with George Clinton, doing the song Stomp.
Nice.
And it was in the middle of a frat party, and I fucking love it.
Right
on. It's because of that that I love the song Stomp. And another one quickly for me was Jonathan Demme's 1986 movie Something Wild,
mm-hmm.
which is highly underrated and is the great, great movie. This is kind of a pervy reason for liking this. There's a song called Ooh Ah by the Fabulous Five, which Melanie Griffith puts on her little stereo right before she has sex with Jeff Daniels after they've run off to a cheap motel together.
Nice.
So that's why I like that song.
Well, actually, speaking of Melanie Griffith, we may as well bring up Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood
and Body Double.
Body Double, because that was another...
I don't get it, man. Melanie Griffith, she was so friggin' hot in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get it.
Hot
like,
no more.
Hot no more. But now her daughter's stinking up the world in 50 Shades of Grey. So what do you know?
Okay, so a few more of these like song uses. I thought I'd bring up the first editions. Just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in from the Big Lebowski. It's another kind of good, really well-known, well-done use of a song. In case you don't know, first editions lead singer was Kenny Rogers. There's also that use of the Ghetto Boys song in Office Space.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what song.
Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, still.
Well, they're beating up the...
The song's called Still.
Oh, is it? Fax Machine? I thought that was pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome because I sometimes fantasize about kicking the shit out of machinery while that song plays in the background as well.
Yeah. So I'm not a big fan of Rob Zombie, but I did think the use of Freebird in The Devil's Rejects was very well
done. That is probably one of the best uses in the last 10 years.
Yeah, that was really well done.
And I think the fact that it was in slow motion tied in well with the song, because I think if they would have done regular speed, it wouldn't have been as effective.
No, but it was really well. Like, mm-hmm. again, like when I hear Freebird, I think of that.
Well, the thing is,
I don't even like the movie.
I do feel like Rob Zombie does do a good job of selecting songs for his movies too, because I remember even in Devil's Rejects, there's that opening credits where they're running away from the police and they keep freeze framing on them running away from police when the names come up, and they're using the Allman Brothers, Not Gonna Catch the Midnight Rider, Midnight Rider song.
Rider, yeah,
and that's a great, great use of Midnight Rider as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So
sure.
He used, that's two songs in one movie that were used really, really well in my eyes.
I think
eyes.
I'm going to check out Devil's Rejects again. I always give Rob Zombie a hard time. I think I might not hate that one as much as the others.
I like Devil's Rejects and House of a Thousand Corpses quite a bit. I just don't like the Halloween ones, and that's why I give them a lot of shit.
Yeah, yeah. A few more. This is a pretty new one, but I was blown away by the use of this one. And again, a little more obscure, but Dwight Twilley's Looking for the Magic in the movie You're Next.
Okay.
In the opening sequence there.
Right.
When the girl turns it on, and then the song makes an appearance a few times because the song is basically put on a repeat on the CD player. But again, really great song that no one fucking knows, but now people maybe do a little bit.
And a really good movie.
Not that tons of people have seen the movie. I also thought the use of Teenage Head, the band, and the song Ain't Got No Sense in Class of 1984 was quite well done. So that's when Stegman and his cronies go to their the punk rock club. They go in, Teenage Head, which is a famous Canadian punk rock band, are playing on stage, and they're playing Ain't Got No Sense, which was one of my favorite songs by them, as they go in and they start slam dancing and stuff. The Buzzcocks is Why Can't I Touch It in the opening credits of The Party Animal, I thought was also... Again,
Jesus.
I know, I'm going super obscure.
You know... I'm going to say something right now that has nothing to do with this topic, but Josh is so freaking obsessed with The Party Animal now since we watched it. He brings it up constantly.
But look, man, I remember when we watched The Party Animal and that Buzzcocks song came up, we both were like, this is awesome.
Well, yeah, that's true. But it's funny how this obscure, shitty, low-budget sex comedy has been sticking with us for so long that we're always thinking about it. We're always doing the hound dog gonna eat that pussy.
Because it fucking rules and everyone should watch it.
Watch Party Animal. You won't regret it.
It's out of print now, so you better get on that shit.
Yeah, get on it.
Another really obvious one, Born to Be Wild and Easy Rider.
Of course.
But again, like that's kind of like, so we're talking way back, but again, tying music with the movie. And then we could go on and on about The Graduate and Simon Garfunkel, but we're not going to.
But I feel like Born to Be Wild has been used in so many frickin' movies since then.
But again, I think of Wyatt and what's his name driving down the fucking
highway
when I'm when I hear that. One Tin Soldier in Billy Jack.
Yep.
Another great one. So that's kind of the end of my, like, you know, uses of songs.
Yep.
But, I mean, fuck, man, like, we're over 2 hours now, and I could still keep going on. Like, I've got a whole page about blaxploitation here, but I think I might save that for maybe a blaxploitation
episode. You should probably do that.
In the future. And just as far as any other soundtracks I want to mention, Bond themes, Bond, I mean, again, a huge association with music with the Bond movies. But, you know, hopefully we'll have a Bond episode if Chris ever watches Bond movies.
I told you, you got to lend me that shit and I'll start watching them.
All right. And then I think we've pretty much covered
so
everything.
Basically what we wanted to get across with this episode.
Dazed and Confused.
That's the
only
other
one I didn't mention.
Go ahead.
It's just, again, another, I think Linklater did a really good job in that movie of incorporating 70s rock and roll into the time frame of when things were happening. And, you know, I mean, it's got Rick Derringer, Foghat, The Runaways, Ted Nugent, Nazareth, Love Hurts Again, Skinner, ZZ Top. I mean, it's again, a very great soundtrack. And I think Linklater picked the songs himself.
Okay.
He seems like the kind of guy that would
do that. Well, anyway. Are you got it? Is that it? You good?
No, I'm not good. Yeah, but fuck it. That's
okay,
it.
So basically, hopefully, what we were trying to get across here is that even though this episode was in a roundabout way about movies, we just wanted to get out there that soundtracks are a very important part of movies, and that without soundtracks, we wouldn't have discovered all these bands. We wouldn't be into some of the songs that we're into, and it just is a full circle, because something that we love, which is movies, that is integrating itself and clicking so well with something else we love, which is movies, is just, it's great. And we wanted to kind of share that idea with you and let you know, like, kind of, if we can turn you on to some new bands, that's totally what we're looking to do.
Totally.
Because who doesn't like to learn about new bands?
Well, and that's why we're doing this, man. I mean, like, again, I think we talked about it in the intro episode that I wish was deleted. But I mean, but I think a lot of what we're trying to do here is I'm really hoping that someone will hear this and will maybe go and, you know, maybe be a little curious about glam rock and will go pick up the fucking Velvet Goldmine soundtrack or watch the fucking movie, for better yet. But, you know, or like if you're into like 70s music, go listen to the Boogie Nights soundtrack or and maybe find a band on there and go buy their album. Maybe you'll go buy the Delfonics album because of Quentin Tarantino. But I think it's really cool that way. And I just think it's a lost. I think we're losing these things with the way the internet is and the way everything is so disposable and convenient.
Yes.
And I just think it's important that we remember that there was a lot of cool shit out there that's, you know, not just one song or one scene. I mean, there's just a lot more going on. And you can put these things together and really have magic. And I think that's the most important thing with this stuff, with the use of music in movies. Like, and I said it earlier today, I mean, I think when you hit that thing where you can get the music and the movie hitting at the same time, it's magical.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
Yeah.
So shall we rap?
Shall we rap?
Not technically rap. White lines, don't do it. Okay, that's enough for me really badly singing and torturing people's eardrums.
You did it a few times
tonight. I know. I can't help it when there's music involved.
Okay, so if you dig what we're doing, please check out our Twitter at GBW Podcast.
Yes. Go to our Facebook at facebook.com/GBW Podcast. And we would really, really dig it if you would go to iTunes, subscribe to us, give us a rating, let us know how we're doing. Give us some feedback.
Yeah.
Give us some topics. Tell us some soundtracks you might dig. And yeah, let's help each other out here.
Yeah, and it would be, yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear more soundtracks. I'd really like to hear some more feedback. I mean, you know, we're doing this to try and turn you guys on to some stuff, but I'd really like someone to, like, point out something that I haven't heard before. I'm always open to stuff like that, and I think we both are.
Yep.
But, I mean, I'd really love to hear something like that and maybe learn something new myself. So please, you know, don't be shy if you're into doing that.
Speak up. We've been doing enough speaking. It's time for you to do some speaking.
Right on. Okay, well, until next time, thanks, everyone.